You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, takes on the world news.
The U.S. government has done some bad things over the years and will almost certainly continue to do them in the years ahead. Foreign policy has very little to do with morality. And as long as any action can be justified by explaining that it was performed in the national interest, that will continue to be the case. And so we give support to repressive governments in South Korea and Brazil and Chile because it is in our national interest to do so. We will supply sophisticated weapons to backward countries and betray an entire people like the Kurds, all because it is in our national interest.
This week in Radical History for the week of November 17th. Inspiration came from the Slingshot organizer, some audio is borrowed from the Radio Roots crew at WBAI in New York, and other radical info can be found in the People's Calendar at the Daily Bleed website.
Yo, check this out, man. There is something going on in the ether.
The kids are now moving back into the street.
For every Martin they cut down, there must be 100 Martins to step into his shoes. Hey!
Proving yet again and breaking the myth that America was founded on religious freedoms, for on November 17, 1637, first American feminist Anna Hutchinson would stand trial for not following the Puritan model. During her trial, when it became obvious that the court would rule against her, she said these words in court, quote, "You have no power over my body, neither can you do me any harm. I fear none but the great Jehovah, which hath foretold me of these things, and I do verily believe he'll deliver me from your hands." She'd be called a heretic and an instrument of the devil. Quoting from the judges, "You have stepped out of your place. You have rather been a husband than a wife, a preacher than a hearer, a magistrate than a subject." Though late in the term with her 15th child, she suffered greatly in jail and would suffer a miscarriage. More feminist news. In 1866, anarchist feminist Valterini D. Claire is born in Leslie, Michigan. She'd teach in Philadelphia and would tour the world lecturing. She once said, "To me, any dependence, anything which destroys the complete selfhood of an individual, is in line of slavery." For her, equality and dignity for both sexes led her to her anarchist beliefs. Also on November 17, 1909, of course, Marines are invading once again, this time in Nicaragua, to protect American interests.
The U.S. government has done some bad things over the years and will almost certainly continue to do them in the years ahead. Foreign policy has very little to do with morality. And as long as any action can be justified by explaining that it was performed in the national interest, that will continue to be the case.
Also on November 17, 1942, hobo organizer, anarchist, and cultural dropout Ben Reitman dies. Dr. Ben Reitman crusaded, was beaten, tarred and feathered, jailed, and run out of town for his efforts on behalf of the rights of women to control their own bodies, and his lifelong efforts to educate and improve the health of hobos. Also on the state in 1978, two FBI agents testified before the House Select Committee on Assassinations that the Bureau's long-term investigation and surveillance of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. was based solely on J. Edgar Hoover's, quote, "hatred of the civil rights leader," unquote, and the civil rights leader's alleged communist influences and linkage with radical groups. People, the time has
come. This is your radio news reporter, Sister Cactus. On this day, November 17th, in 1983, the Zapatista Army of National Liberation, the EZLN, was founded in Chiapas, Mexico, by members of various rebel movements. The group of six men and women opposed the oppression and exploitation of indigenous peoples throughout the globalized world. When the EZLN appeared about 10 years later, in 1994, they had taken hold of five municipalities in Chiapas and declared war against the Mexican state. They have battled constant armed suppression from the Mexican military. However, they have also established an autonomous education and healthcare system, complete with its own schools, hospitals, and pharmacies, which are governed by a collectively established set of revolutionary laws. The Zapatista movement is a great example of collective revolution, and it is important that this kind of work is being done. Yeah, I said it. This is your free speech educator reminding you to never let the past slip away. People, the time has
come. This is your radio news reporter, Citra Cactus. On this day, November 18th, in 1903, the Ibanao-Varilla Treaty was signed, giving the United States government exclusive rights to construct and manage the 10-mile-wide strip of the Panama Canal. The treaty was signed 2 weeks after Panama's independence from Colombia, which was backed by the U.S. after the Colombian government refused to cooperate with the Roosevelt administration.
The negotiation is also known as the Treaty No Panamanian Sign because it was created and signed by the U.S. Secretary of State and a French engineer, Philippe Bonal Varela. For 96 years, the U.S. retained rights over the canal, which was a constant source of conflict and violence between the people of Panama and the U.S. military.
Yeah, I said it. This is your free speech educator reminding you to never let the past slip away.
This week in Radical History for November 19th, 1493, Christopher Columbus, quote, discovers, unquote, Puerto Rico. And the Spaniards, once they are shown a gold nugget from the Puerto Rico River, decide that they will stay. They regularly would feed Indian infants to their dogs alive, and at times while the horror-stricken parents would watch. The Spaniards would also host contests to see who could cut through a living person in half with one stroke of their sword. They would test the sharpness of their blades by beheading the nearest handy native. A little reminder of next time you want to celebrate Christopher Columbus. Also on November 19, 1915, IWW labor organizer, folk poet Joe Hill, murdered by firing squad in Utah. The subject of numerous songs, plays, and books. His last words to the labor organized supporters and friends of his was, "Don't mourn, organize." Here's a part of just one song of Joe Hill.
I dreamed I saw Joe Hill last night, alive as you and me. Says I, but Joe, you're 10 years dead. I never died, says he.
Lastly, for November 19, 2001, the Bush regime accuses Iraq and North Korea of developing germ warfare programs. Around the same time, Bush famously says in a speech that the United States never used weapons of mass destruction. I think the victims of Hiroshima and Nagasaki would not agree with him. On this day in Radical History for November 20, 1816, the term scab is used for the first time at Albany Typographic Society by author Jack London. To quote Jack London about scabs, "After God had finished the rattlesnake, the toad, the vampire, he had some awful substance left with which he made the scab. A scab is a two-legged animal with a corkscrew soul, a water-legged brain, a combination backbone of jelly and glue. When a scab comes down the street, men turn their backs, angels weep in heaven, and the devil shuts the gates of hell to keep him out. Judas was a gentleman compared to a scab. For betraying his master, he had the character enough to hang himself. A scab has not." Jack London. Also on this date in 1856, U.S. Marines fight in the Battle of Canton Forts in China. Apparently, there's no place on Earth that the U.S. has not interest in to protect.
The U.S. government has done some bad things over the years and will almost certainly continue to do them in the years ahead. Foreign policy has very little to do with morality. And as long as any action can be justified by explaining that it was performed in the national interest, that will continue to be the case.
Also on this date, in 1892, in more labor news, hired thugs, gunmen, and state militia break the Homestead Carnegie strike that began on the 1st. On this date in 1969, Indians from 20 tribes seize and occupy Alcatraz Island in San Francisco Bay. American Indian Movement activists occupy the island for 19 months. They offer to pay $24 in glass and beads and red cloth for the land, the price paid by the whites for Manhattan Island. In a little bit of Wisconsin news, on November 20th, 1993, as Wisconsin deer hunters take to the woods and fields on opening day of gun hunting season, Alliance for Animal members protest at Devil's Lake State Park. They try to point out that this yearly ritual actually thins the deer herds of the healthiest and leaves the scrawniest and most sick behind, a kind of anti-evolutionary practice that actually weakens the herds, not strengthens them, for most hunters want the big bucks and will pass on anything that looks sickly. Now in Wisconsin, like many other places in the United States, chronic wasting disease is running rampant through the unhealthy herds and passing the spraying disease onto hunters who kill and eat them. We should all understand fully now with war and hunting practices that though we have evolved enough to be able to make guns, we have not evolved enough to be wise about how to use guns. On a related subject and showing how smart we really are, on November 20th in 2002, the National Geographic Survey found that 11% of all U.S. residents cannot find the United States on a world map, yet they can still have guns. On this day in radical history for November 21st, I only have one item, 1897, Molly Stemmer is born. Anarchist and labor agitator, her militant activities got her deported from the United States in 1921 for distributing literature against the U.S. invasion of Russia. Then when they forced the Russia, she'd be deported from Russia 2 years later for distributing anarchist literature. Both lands showing true freedom. On this day in radical history for November 22nd, New York female garment workers call for general strike, leading to the, quote, uprising of 20,000, unquote. The International Ladies Garment Workers Union strikes against sweatshop conditions, also called the Girls' Revolt, wins support from other workers and the women's suffragette movement in their persistence and unity in the face of police brutality and rigged courtrooms, as many of the picketers are beaten and fired. In the end, the garment workers would win a pay raise and work reduction to 52 hours a week. A great quote comes from a British journalist, atheist, and anarchist, Nicholas Walter, who was born on this date in 1934. He once wrote, "Many people say that government is necessary because some men cannot be trusted to look out for themselves. But anarchists say that government is harmful because no man can be trusted to look after anyone else. Amen, brother." Also on this date in 1936, over 500,000 attend the funeral of anarchist Durruti in Barcelona, who lost his life fighting against the fascists in Spain. Also on November 22, 1967, UN adopts Resolution 242 calling for Israel withdraw from the occupied territories. They still have not left Palestine, 41 years later. Though Iraq was in violation of 17 UN resolutions, Israel is in violation of 2.5 times as many, yet we don't invade Israel. Lastly, on this date in 1985, 143 surviving Kickapoo Indians on the Texas-Mexican border are given U.S. citizenship, ending a 140-year U.S. refusal to allow Kickapoo to live legally on their own lands. On this day in radical history, for November 23rd, we only have two items, 1903, Army troops dispatched to Cripple Creek, Colorado, to put down rebellion by coal-striking miners. Paid by miner owners and estate, General Sherman Bell and his men arrive and throw 600 Union workers into a military bullpen, holding them for weeks without charges. When a lawyer appears with a writ of habeas corpus, the general says, quote, "Habeas corpus, hell, we'll give them postmortems," unquote. Lastly, in 1981, acting President Ronald Reagan authorized the CIA to form paramilitary squads of Nicaraguan exiles to overthrow the government. This is the same clown who, on September 28, 1990, with a completely straight face, claims, quote, "We have never interfered in the eternal government of any country," unquote. And of course, from 1855 to 1981, there has been at least 40 military interventions in Mexico, South America, and the Caribbean alone.
The U.S. government has done some bad things over the years and will almost certainly continue to do them in the years ahead. Foreign policy has very little to do with morality. And as long as any action can be justified by explaining that it was performed in the national interest, that will continue to be the case.
This has been This Week in Radical History, produced at the Glee Glee Studios. Inspiration came from the Slingshot Organizer. Google the Slingshot Collective for more info. Special thanks to the Radio Roots crew at WBAI New York, whose great audio I borrowed for the show. And more radical info can be found at the Daily Bleed website. Google the Daily Bleed for more radical information. Comments or suggestions, please consider emailing me at themikecannonshow@hotmail.com. Cannon spelled C-A-N-N-O-N. That's themikecannonshow@hotmail.com. Reminder what anarchist and feminist Emma Goldman said. If voting never really changed anything, they would have made it illegal. This has been This Week in Radical History, and until next week, as always, I'm yours in a struggle, Mike Cannon.
Give these people a voting day every year so that they'll have the illusion of meaningless choice. Meaningless choice that we go like slaves and say, "Yeah, I voted."
You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, This Week in Palestine.
Good morning, everyone, and welcome to This Week in Palestine, a weekly broadcast of news, analysis, commentary, and discussion of issues relevant to the Palestinian struggle for freedom from Israel's brutal occupation and colonization of their homeland. This program features the Palestinian voice, the Palestinian narrative, from a perspective we do not get in the mainstream media. This Week in Palestine was created by Sharif Pham and is continued in his memory. And this is your host, John Roberts. This morning we feature the first of what will be several presentations recorded at the conference titled Balfour's Legacy, Confronting the Consequences, held on November 11th at the First Parish Church in Cambridge. The conference was sponsored by the Alliance for Water Justice in Palestine and the Trans-Arab Research Institute. The quality of the presentations was incredible, and we want to bring you as many of them as possible over the next several weeks on This Week in Palestine. We begin this morning with the keynote address delivered by Youssef Munayer, Executive Director of the U.S. Campaign for Palestinian Rights.
Thank you so much for that very kind introduction, Elaine. Let me begin by saying that all of us can be inspired by what is a truly dynamic young generation of activists and scholars working on Palestine. But this is a generation that follows in the footsteps of those who came before us, like Elaine, like Nasir Arouri, and like so many more who have given us the foundation from which to take our struggle forward. It's a pleasure and honor to be able to join you here for this important conference. I want to thank the organizers and attendees who are making this success possible, and I was happy to accept the invitation to deliver this address today. I will discuss Palestine rights work in the United States under the presidency of Donald Trump. Before we can appreciate the work that lies ahead of us, however, it's important to first understand the pre-existing context we operated in ahead of this Trumpian moment. Our organization is a coalition of over 300 member groups across the United States working for Palestinian rights. Founded in 2001, the U.S. campaign included organizations large and small, many of them represented in this room, of various identities and in various locations across the country. Prior to the advent of the BDS call in 2005, the Boycott, Divestment, and Sanctions call, which I believe we are all familiar with in this room, the U.S. campaign was engaged in efforts to end U.S. military aid to Israel by focusing on Washington, D.C. Our organization is also part of a movement for Palestinian rights inside the United States and out. In the U.S. in particular, the Palestinian rights movement has a rich history which predates the establishment of Israel and was largely conducted by Arab American organizations for many decades. Advocacy for Palestinian rights relied on many traditional tactics, including educational and informational campaigns aimed at public opinion as well as congressional advocacy. Here it's important to say a word about the U.S.-Israel relationship. As you know, the movement for Palestinian rights is a global one, and it's important to send Israel a message from every corner of the globe that its denial of Palestinian rights is unacceptable. However, not all relationships are created equal. The U.S.-Israel relationship, more than Israel's relationship with any other country or group of countries, is the single most important relationship that Israel has. Washington's support for Israel is the very backbone of Israel's abuses. Without American support, it's hard to imagine how Israel could continue to employ its abusive policies. For this reason, our work here in the United States is both of great consequence, but is also very challenging. Just as we know the importance of the U.S.-Israel relationship, so too do Israel's supporters and allies who are working to maintain the status of this relationship. Pro-Israel interest groups have invested heavily in developing and maintaining relations between Washington and Tel Aviv for decades. Thus, the traditional channels of advocacy, particularly as it relates to policy change, are extremely difficult for us to navigate. I cannot tell you the number of times members of Congress or their staff have privately and even sometimes publicly told Palestine rights advocates, "I agree with you, but if I did anything on this, it would cost me dearly." The extent to which a Zionist consensus exists on Capitol Hill would make you think that it is not a hill in Washington, D.C., but an Israeli colonized hilltop in the West Bank. No matter how many letters were written to Congress, how many phone calls were made by constituents, to members' offices, the efforts often came up empty. This, of course, had a very discouraging and demoralizing effect on activists engaged in Palestinian rights advocacy. So it was in this context that the BDS call arrived onto the scene. While the idea of divestment existed before 2005, and indeed divestment campaigns were being organized and even won on campuses prior to the 2005 call. Shout out to Hampshire College here in Massachusetts, who succeeded back in 2004. The call, nonetheless, 12 years ago, formalized the use of these tactics in a Palestinian-led framework for the first time. It's no exaggeration to say that the embrace of these tactics by Palestinian rights activists in the United States had a revolutionary impact on the movement. The call gave activists new ways to organize, new spaces to organize in, new targets to aim for, and, most importantly, an opportunity to win. Perhaps it was too difficult at the moment to get the U.S. government to address its complicity in Israeli abuses. But what about the complicity of various levels in society below the government level? There is the individual, community, organizational, institutional, and local government complicity that could be addressed by campaigns with specific targets. These campaigns could operate in an arena with far less competition than in the halls of Congress, making them imminently more winnable. This quickly translated to optimism, engagement, buy-in, commitment, and the desire to do more campaign-related work. Suddenly, an effort that had become debilitating and discouraging became dynamic, energizing, and empowering instead. In the United States, BDS campaigns have seen numerous successes in the past 12 years. On our website, you can view a list of all of the victories that have been amassed over this time. Two things immediately jump out when looking at this list. First, the sheer diversity of victories is impressive. Corporate divestment victories, church divestment, cultural boycott, university boycott, professional association boycott or divestment victories, and the list goes on. Second, the accelerated pace of these victories over time. In the early years after the call, victories were less prevalent, but in recent years they've been increasingly frequent as the use of these tactics grows. Our organization used to spend more time helping groups start campaigns, but now we do a lot less of that. Self-starting campaigns take off around the country, sometimes thanks to pre-existing resources, but often also out of the initiative of local organizers. Now, much more of our work and our time is spent coordinating and providing support for campaigns that are up and running on their own. So now that we've discussed the context as it relates to the great growth of the movement, it's important to understand the political context in the United States ahead of the election that brought us Donald Trump and the space it afforded for Palestinian rights work. During the Obama era, despite his stalwart support for Israel on par or beyond any of his predecessors, we witnessed an unprecedented shift in public opinion on Israel in the United States that largely followed partisan lines. This is significant because in American politics, even when Republicans and Democrats couldn't agree on whether it was night or day outside, they always, always agreed on Israel. Now, suddenly, this was starting to change. This change took place for several reasons that are very important to understand. The first was Obama the person. Barack Hussein Obama was elected the first black president of the United States, but to many in Israel, they could not get past his middle name, or the fact that his father was a Muslim, or that he spent time in Indonesia growing up, or that he had a dinner conversation once with Edward Said and was acquainted with Rashid Khalidi. Obama was also viewed with suspicion at the highest levels of the Israeli government because it was believed that Obama sympathized with the Palestinian narrative more than the Israeli narrative. The second factor was Benjamin Netanyahu. Netanyahu's premiership in Israel essentially overlapped with Obama's presidency for all but a few months. Each government Netanyahu formed was a right-wing government strongly supportive of settlement expansion, which caused friction with Obama's Washington as they spoke of advancing peace negotiations. This tension was evident from the outset of the relationship between the two leaders, and Netanyahu's way of dealing with it was to change the subject away from peace, settlements, and Palestinian rights to Iran, 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 and did I mention Iran as well? This brings us to the third important factor in the partisan divide. That is the Iran deal. Obama viewed the region in a way that the Israelis did not like. He sought to stabilize it not through massive deployment, but through the pursuit of political agreements, and he saw an opening with Iran that allowed him to pursue the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, the JCPOA, which would bring Iran in line with its commitments under the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty. While this would result in an unprecedented inspections regime on Tehran's nuclear program, the likes of which the world had not seen, it would also mean that the Iranian government would be given a path out of the isolation the international community had imposed on it. Netanyahu and many in Israel who see no option other than the eventual regime change in Iran viewed this as a mistake and worked as hard as possible to torpedo the Iran deal. With nuclear nonproliferation being highest on Obama's national security agenda, the Iran deal would be a significant policy achievement that advanced American national security interests while also keeping a promise he had made on the campaign trail about the willingness to talk to the Iranians and advance relations out of mutual respect. The fight over the Iran deal was on, and it was a vicious one that quickly became hyperpartisan. For Obama's opponents, some of whom had accused the president of being too kind to American adversaries, and others who even claimed he was not an American and seeking to subvert it from the inside, the politics around the Iran deal was fuel for their fire. Many of Obama's supporters, though, not only agreed with the Iran deal for its national security objectives, but they also grew angry at allegations of traitorism against their president, which they saw as often racially coded language. Let me say a few words about these narratives. Pro-Israel advocacy in the United States has always come not just from Jewish Zionist voices or institutions, but from evangelical Zionist ones as well, a demographic that has for generations been at the base of the Republican Party. But it was more recently, during the two Bush administrations, that this constituency really started to flex its muscles. The confluence of multiple American wars in Muslim countries, 9/11, the War on Terror, and the Second Intifada helped sew together a clash of civilizations narrative that dominated the political discourse on the right and beyond. The discourse was clear about the axes of good and evil. Predominantly white, Judeo-Christian civilization was on one side, and Islam was on the other. Enter Hussein Obama. the first African-American president and the first physical manifestation of the minority-majority American future. Among the immediate reactions to Obama's triumph was birtherism, the Tea Party, and the narrative that undergirded both. Obama is not one of us. But these reactionary movements shared this core analysis with a more intellectual-seeming group. In right-wing neoconservative circles, the same narrative was congealing around Obama and one core issue, Israel. Take, for example, a book published in 2009 by National Review writer Michael Ledeen, which gave Obama a whole 8 months before rendering the verdict very clearly. The book was titled Obama's Betrayal of Israel. For others, where the verdict on Obama was still out, one question loomed large. Does Obama really feel it in the kishkis for Israel? Obama, of course, was as pro-Israel as any of his predecessors. But that didn't stop certain pro-Israel voices on the right, like Charles Krauthammer, who argued in a column titled, It's Obama vs. Israel. Searching for the source of Obama's hatred of Israel, Krauthammer wondered if it stemmed from Obama's penchant for appeasing enemies while beating up on allies. Or perhaps it was because Obama wanted to heal the breach between Christianity and Islam and has little patience for this pesky Jewish state. Over at the Weekly Standard, Bill Kristol told us that Obama was angry, accelerating both his appeasement of Iran and his attacks on Israel. But there was good news. The Republican Party, he writes, and the conservative movement, and most of the American people, stand with Israel against President Obama. Kristol also set up something called the Emergency Committee for Israel, a right-wing attack operation intended to counterbalance J Street, which was seen as giving Obama Jewish cover. What was the emergency? It was Hussein Obama, just as the robocall supporting Netanyahu's re-election in Israel had called him. The Emergency Committee for Israel has now changed its name to the Committee for Israel since the election. I'm not joking. They've literally declared the emergency over now that the first black president has been replaced by the white supremacist in chief. Then you have Bret Stephens, who argued that Obama not only betrayed Israel, but that he had systematically failed to oppose every adversary, from the Iranian regime to Bashar al-Assad to Russia to the Muslim Brotherhood. And who did Bret Stephens say was most betrayed by President Obama, the first African-American president? Americans. This narrative flowed back and forth between these voices on the right, like Robert Spencer or Dick Cheney or Sean Hannity or Alan West, who wrote, for example, "The barbarians are indeed at the gate. But there are also traitors within our ranks. If Barack Obama goes to the United Nations Security Council and drops the veto in support for the two-state solution, I believe we will see the latter enable the former." Likewise, Mike Huckabee and Newt Gingrich, two of the President Trump's early supporters, helped carry the tune of dog whistles. Gingrich argued that Obama is so outside of our comprehension, he can only be understood by knowing Kenyan anti-colonial behavior. Mike Huckabee told Fox News viewers, everything Obama does is against what Christians stand for. He's against the Jews in Israel. Furthermore, he argued, the one group of people that can know they have his undying, unfailing support would be the Muslim community. And it doesn't matter whether it's the radical Muslim community or the more moderate Muslim community. But opposing Obama on Israel had a deeper impact than these pundits may have reckoned with. And it is well illustrated in an episode from 2016 involving Jennifer Rubin, who wrote a Washington Post column called Why It's Correct to Label the Obama Administration Anti-Israel. She concluded that the Obama administration was the most anti-Israel in history and a disloyal, unhelpful ally. But her article, which was typical of her output during the 8 years of Obama's presidency, had a ripple effect. It was amplified on a website called Breitbart News, which Steve Bannon called the platform of the alt-right, precisely because it reinforced their narrative. In other words, the white supremacist home base saw no contradiction between Rubin's analysis of Obama and Israel and their own worldview. And this is exactly the point. Not only did these pundits not contradict the ideological undercurrent of the alt-right, they provided a piece of the paradigm, with their insistence over and over again on an us versus them mentality. The fight over the Iran deal, during which much of this narrative swirled, put Israel, Republicans, Islamophobes, and racists of various stripes on one side, and the president, Democrats, multiculturalists on another. It came to a climax when then Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu secured an invitation to speak before a joint session of Congress through the Republican Speaker of the House, circumventing the White House purely for the purpose of lobbying against the president's agenda. This meant that the Republican Speaker of the House was cooperating with a foreign leader in an effort to derail the signature foreign policy objective of the American president. As a result, a stunning 60 members of Congress, senators and representatives alike, almost all Democrats, chose to skip the speech of Benjamin Netanyahu and held press conferences instead explaining why they did so. Many of them were members of the Congressional Black Caucus. The speech of an Israeli prime minister before the American Congress is a sickening display which has become known for featuring more standing ovations than the annual State of the Union address delivered by the president himself. So for 60 members of Congress to skip out on this high-profile address was a stunning rebuke for Netanyahu and a sign of the times. So this brings us to the fourth factor driving the partisan divide, an important one during the Obama era and perhaps even more important during the Trump era, which is now upon us. And that is what Obama represented. Barack Hussein Obama represented a changing America, a majority-minority country which was headed in the direction of more people of color assuming decision-making roles. Obama represented a certain ethos that would be at the center of the political battle boiling in the next election. That ethos is one of civic belonging, one that prioritizes democracy over identity. American as an idea, not a color, ethnicity, or religion. America does not cease to exist if it no longer has a white Christian majority. The same cannot be said for the Israeli ethos, however. This is an ethos that prioritizes identity over democracy. Obama represented an America that was becoming more demographically diverse and was okay with it, or so we thought. Israel, on the other hand, considers demographic changes to be existential threats. This contrast became clear in the Obama era, and it became clearer still in the Trump era. So this brings us to the election just over a year ago today. The last American presidential election was probably the most covered and most followed political contest in modern history. It was a campaign unlike any other we had seen in the United States, pitting the most insider of insiders in Hillary Clinton against the most unorthodox of outsiders in Donald J. Trump. Neither of them was particularly good on Palestine or a friend to BDS. Hillary Clinton made a commitment on the campaign trail to combat the BDS movement, in large part as a response to her largest donor, Haim Saban, who has made fighting BDS a priority. Donald Trump's pro-Israel bona fides were laid out at the annual AIPAC conference and in many statements before and after. We prepared for a Clinton presidency. Why? Because every poll and almost every analyst had her winning comfortable. And frankly, how on earth could one prepare for a Trump presidency even if you thought he was going to win? Everyone knew Clinton was a vulnerable candidate. She entered into the contest as the only nominee in Democratic Party history to have an unfavorable rating above 50%. She was running against an opponent, however, who had an unfavorable rating close to 60%. While Trump may have been the only candidate Clinton could beat, the inverse was likely also true. How convinced were we that Clinton was going to win? We had an email prepared to go out to our supporters, loaded up, to blast out to tens of thousands of people, saying something to the effect of, "Clinton has won, what is next for BDS?" One of the challenges we expected to arise that would impact our work should Clinton win would be the rollback of this partisan divide on Israel. We imagined that Clinton, who had committed to inviting Netanyahu to the White House in her first 100 days, would reset relations with Israel and make clear that there was no partisan divide. With Hussein Obama now out of the way, business as usual in the U.S.-Israel relationship would return. But of course, Clinton did not win, and we got Trump instead. We wrote a different email. While we were not expecting Trump, we were forced to begin thinking about how our work would change under a Trump presidency. Our initial thinking was heavily influenced by the sheer shock of what took place. Not only was the outcome a surprise, But what this outcome could mean could be devastating. Aside from the pernicious policies Trump supported towards immigrants, refugees, and the outside world in general, he rode to power on a wave of nativist, xenophobic white nationalism that would continue to be empowered after his victory. Trump had won despite making attacking the press a cornerstone of his campaigning, and he was surrounded by some key advisors who had a clash of civilizations mindset that advocated for eternal war with Islam. Some think tanks friendly to Trump had made combating BDS a priority, including through attacking Muslim American organizations that practice BDS, like American Muslims for Palestine, one of our coalition groups who has recently come under the crosshairs of legal targeting. And while he continued to attack minorities, he also continued to embrace Israel, and in particular, Benjamin Netanyahu. Take, for example, his behavior this past December when he was president-elect and the UN Security Council was voting on a resolution to condemn settlements that Obama ultimately permitted to pass by withholding his veto. Netanyahu worked to stop the resolution, and when the White House refused to commit to veto it, Netanyahu called Trump. Trump then called Egypt's El-Sisi, whose ambassador had introduced the resolution, and Egypt withdrew it. However, four other countries were prepared to move ahead with it, and the vote ultimately happened with a U.S. abstention. Trump, as he always does, let his thoughts be known to the world on Twitter, slamming the Obama administration for throwing Israel under the bus and promising that things would be different come January 20th, which was Inauguration Day. He had also promised to move the U.S. Embassy to Jerusalem during this time. Netanyahu properly thanked him for his support on Twitter and looked forward to the new relationship. Soon, these two tweeting lovebirds would continue to exchange public messages of support. When President Trump made clear he wanted to build an even bigger wall to prevent immigrants from coming to the United States from Mexico, Netanyahu tweeted that Israel built a wall and walls work. Trump would soon cite him in a TV interview. Shortly after inauguration, it was announced that Netanyahu would be the first foreign leader to officially visit the White House after Prime Minister Theresa May of the United Kingdom. Netanyahu's trip was planned for February 15th, the day after Valentine's Day. The Love Fest provided us an opportunity. Trump was a remarkably unpopular figure in the United States and only becoming more despised, particularly among Democrats, including those who did not support Palestinian rights or BDS. Being in opposition to Trump is where all the energy, power, and dynamism was, and being able to brand Israel and Benjamin Netanyahu as Trump allies was a way to continue to open eyes in progressive and liberal circles in the United States. These two leaders were largely doing the work for us, but we took pleasure in launching the Bad Romance campaign, which was timed around Netanyahu's Valentine's Day visit to the White House. This video and petition campaign shed light on the common agenda between Netanyahu and Trump, as well as the chummy support they showed each other in curtailing the rights of darker-skinned people under their rule. Additionally, the Trump-Netanyahu love affair sent a shock through much of the American Jewish community, which votes overwhelmingly liberal. Trump's campaign brought all sorts of white nationalists out of the woodwork, leading to a spike in both Islamophobic and anti-Semitic incidents. Yet at the press conference between both leaders, the leader of the so-called State of the Jewish People provided backing when Trump faced the question about his campaign's role in fueling anti-Semitism. This showed what many of us had known for a very long time, that Zionism had a tolerance for anti-Semitism, and it was the idea that acted as its very raison d'etre. This attitude was once again on display this summer, when Netanyahu's government retracted a statement condemning an anti-Semitic ad targeting George Soros, an Israel critic and philanthropist in Hungary. Or when Netanyahu's son, Yair, or the head of the Israeli-American coalition, Adam Milstein, shared social media memes attacking critics of Israel using anti-Semitic tropes. The concert between Zionism, anti-Semitism, ethno-nationalism, and nativist racism is particularly appropriate to discuss as we reflect on the topic of this conference, the legacy of Arthur Balfour. Though he may be most known for aiding Zionists in 1917, it's crucial to remember that Arthur Balfour was, in fact, a white supremacist. He made that much clear in his own words. In 1906, the House of Commons in the UK was engaged in a debate about whether or not the native black population in South Africa should have a right to vote. Most members of Parliament agreed that the disenfranchisement of blacks was evil, but not Arthur Balfour, who almost alone argued against it. "We have to face the facts," Balfour said. "Men are not born equal. The white and black races are not born with equal capacities. They are born with different capacities, which education cannot and will not change." But Balfour's troubling views, of course, were not limited to Africa. In fact, despite his now iconic support for Zionism, he was not exactly a friend to the Jews. In the late 19th century, pogroms targeting Jews in the Pale of Settlement had led to waves of Jewish flight westward to England and the United States. This influx of refugees led to an increase in British anti-immigrant racism and outright anti-Semitism, themes that are not unfamiliar to our politics today. Support for political action against immigrants grew as the English public demanded immigration control to keep certain immigrants, particularly Jews, out of the country. In 1905, while serving as Prime Minister, Balfour presided over the passage of the Aliens Act. This legislation put the first restrictions on immigration into Great Britain, and it was primarily aimed at restricting Jewish immigration. It may seem astonishing that Balfour, whose support for the Zionist cause has made him a hero among many Jews, would have implemented anti-Jewish laws. But the truth is, his support for Zionism stemmed from the exact same source as his desire to limit Jewish immigration into Britain. Both can be traced back to his white supremacist beliefs. Balfour lived in an era of stirring nationalism, highly defined by ethno-religious identity. Because of these sentiments, the early 20th century was a time when ostensibly liberal Western nations struggled with the challenge of incorporating Jewish citizens. What the Zionists provided for Balfour was a solution to the challenges Jewish citizens posed to his ethno-nationalist vision, a solution that didn't force him to reckon with them. Instead of insisting that societies accept all citizens as equals, regardless of racial or religious background, the Zionist movement offered a different answer: separation. Balfour saw in Zionism not just a blessing for the Jews, but a blessing for the West as well. And he wrote in 1919 that the Zionist movement would, quote, "mitigate the age-long miseries created for Western civilization by the presence in its midst of a body which it too long regarded as alien and even hostile, but which it equally was unable to expel or absorb." By both giving Jews a place to go and a place to leave, Zionism seemingly solved two problems at once. In Balfour's mind, in other words, his support for Zionism was motivated to an extent by his desire to protect Britain from the negative effects of the, quote, miseries of having Jews in its midst. Rather than protecting the rights of one of its minorities, Britain could simply encourage exporting them, or at least not import anymore. Needless to say, his view of Zionism is steeped in the same kind of white supremacy as his views on South Africa's blacks. But his support for the Zionist dream had another problem. Rather than solving the problem of how to handle a minority living in a white-majority country, the Balfour Declaration just shifted the same problem into a different geography. For the tension between ethno-nationalism and equality is equally present today between the Jordan River and the Mediterranean Sea, where the Israeli state rules over the fate of millions of Palestinians who either have no right to vote, are treated as second-class citizens, or are refugees denied repatriation. Today, it is Israel that views Palestinians, like myself, as demographic threats and sees, quote, "the presence in its midst of a body which it too long regarded as alien and even hostile, but which it was equally unable to expel or absorb." That Balfour's legacy of supremacy persists as much as British support for Israel is no accident. We have arrived at this point today because the supremacist attitudes of Balfour informed policy, lending imperial might to the pursuit of a project for national self-determination for Jews by trampling on the rights of native non-Jews. Remarkably, Balfour was unabashedly aware of the hypocrisy of his stance. Quote, "The weak point of our position, of course, is that in the case of Palestine, we deliberately and rightly decline to accept the principle of self-determination, he wrote in 1919. We do not propose to even go through the form of consulting the wishes of the present inhabitants of the country, the 700,000 Arabs who now inhabit that ancient land. Those Arabs, of course, made up 90% of the population, if not more. My grandparents, along with, I'm sure, the relatives of many in this room, were among them. Therein lies the fundamental problem that continues through this day, 100 years later. Palestinians are denied the right to have rights because from the very outset, their views, their human rights, and by extension, their very humanity were consistently seen as inferior to those of others. That was clear in Balfour's perspective and the British Mandate's policy, and it persists in one form or another in the many policies of the Israeli state through this day. Today, as much as in 1917, the battle between ethno-nationalism and equality, between particularism and universalism, has risen to the foreground, from Donald Trump's rise in America to Theresa May's Brexited Britain. Rather than resolving this tension, Balfour's support for Zionism merely exported it to Palestine. The ideology that Trump rode into power favored a very similar Herrenvolk nationalism. It holds that a country is for a people, not for many peoples. Zionism fits this worldview very well. Exposing this to those in liberal and progressive circles in the United States who have not yet taken a stand on Palestinian rights will be one of our key tasks in the Trump era. Moving forward, we must do several things. First, we must build towards the S. While we have had success over the past 12 years in many B and D campaigns, there is much work yet to do to getting to the S, the sanctions. Israel's U.S. government-level sanctions on Israel would be a game-changer, and we should not shy away from or be intimidated by this objective. Rather, we must assess what it takes to get to this goal, be realistic about the time that it will take to get there, build the power necessary to march down this path, and do so unapologetically. This is a longer-term objective, and while it is unclear exactly how long it will take, it is clear that it is beyond 3 to 5 years. The question for us in the Trump era is how best to build towards this ultimate goal in the political context we operate in during this period. Now I want to outline challenges and opportunities on this path that we will encounter and will feature heavily in our work in the years to come. First, and perhaps most importantly, we must intersectionally organize. Something very important happened in the summer of 2014. As you all know, that summer, Israel bombarded Gaza for 55 hellish days, killing well over 2,000 Palestinians, most of whom, as always, were civilians. The war on Gaza received massive coverage in the United States, albeit primarily filtered through a pro-Israel lens, and was the lead story on almost every day of the summer and in every newscast. But what may be less known outside the United States is that in the second week of August, just as the war in Gaza was beginning to wind down, attention in the United States turned to the story of Michael Brown, an 18-year-old African-American from Ferguson, Missouri, just outside of St. Louis. The unarmed Brown was shot to death by a white police officer and had his hands up at the time of the shooting. The case recentered the discussion about police brutality in the United States and the legacy of racism in American institutions, especially in law enforcement. But the fact that it came during the war on Gaza meant that those following the news, both on traditional and social media, were confronted by a striking juxtaposition. State violence aimed at upholding a system of injustice on the other side of the world and in our own backyard. As protesters gathered in the streets of Missouri only to be met with a harsh police response, activists from Palestine sent messages with tips on how to mitigate the influence of tear gas. Others circulated images of identical tear gas canisters used 6,000 miles apart, made by the same corporation in Pennsylvania. Palestinian keffiyehs could be seen in the streets of Ferguson during the protests. The connections were just too prevalent to ignore. This episode highlights one of the many intersectional organizing opportunities that offer a path to building coalitions with groups and movements who are unaware of our work and afford us an opportunity to support their work as well. There are intersections with Palestinian rights issues and various other issues of importance in the United States, including some that have come to the fore in the recent years and months after Trump. For example, did you know that the company that helped build Israel's wall in the West Bank and helped encage Gaza is considered to be the front runner for the contract to expand Trump's wall to keep immigrants out? Or that G4S, which has long been a BDS target, is deeply enmeshed in the American prison industrial complex? Long before Donald Trump banned refugees, Israel had its own refugee ban, preventing many of my family members, for example, from returning to their homeland. As awareness of communities of color coming into the crosshairs of state policy and rhetoric grows, the opportunities to create alliances, coalitions, and insert the issue of Palestinian rights firmly into the fold of progressive and liberal priorities continues to grow as well. Second, we must work to reform an anti-lobbying culture. An unfortunate byproduct of the success of BDS tactics is that it's directed grassroots energy away from focused engagement with policymakers in the federal government. As activists get used to working on divestment campaigns targeting either a corporation or aiming for a resolution in this church or that university, they're honing organizing skills for those campaigns while not developing lobbying skills needed for effective government engagement. As I noted earlier, BDS tactics provided something of a refuge for activists who were tired of getting nowhere with Congress. But here's the hard truth. There is no way to sanctions without going through Congress. This means that at some point that engagement needs to happen, and the sooner it starts, the better. This is not to say there's no engagement with lawmakers. There is. But there can certainly be much more, and there will have to be much more for us to achieve the goals we want to see, and the anti-lobbying culture that has arisen as a byproduct of focused B and D work makes this more difficult. Addressing this culture and correcting it will be a big task for us in the years ahead. Third, we must confront lawfare. An additional challenge we've been confronting in the United States, and I know there's going to be a workshop on this afternoon, is the lawfare efforts aimed at repressing the Palestinian rights movement by attempting to criminalize BDS tactics. We have seen multiple pieces of legislation in state legislatures across the United States aimed at this purpose over the last 2 years, and we have organized local coalitions to fight them, with success in some areas, but not in all. As a group of organizations with relatively small capacity in comparison to what we are up against, we must be careful not to get bogged down fighting anti-BDS legislation to the point where it is all-consuming. Tying us up playing defense so that we are incapable of playing offense and burning out our resources is precisely what our adversaries would like to see. At the same time, we cannot ignore such legislation. We must triage the situation and strategically address state legislation where we can. We are working with other groups to educate activists about their rights, which is a key component to defeating the chilling effect that these laws intend to inspire. While we do have President Trump, we also still have the Constitution, at least for now. What is so important about this is that unlike places like France, for example, where the state can take draconian steps against BDS activity, political boycotts are considered free expression and protected here under the First Amendment to the Constitution and have been upheld as such by the Supreme Court of the United States. For this reason, anti-BDS laws in the United States can only go so far before crossing a constitutional line that would open them to legal challenge in the courts. We have noticed that anti-BDS law drafters have attempted to tiptoe up to this line in some places, but elsewhere have crossed it, almost testing to see how much they can get away with. Legal challenges have already begun. This summer, an important battle against a piece of federal legislation called the Israel Anti-Boycott Act began. As written, it could lead to civil and even criminal penalties for BDS-type activities, with up to $1 million fine and 20 years in prison. We have seen the American Civil Liberties Union, the ACLU, join alongside us to defeat this legislation. This is very important for several reasons. First, while we have been screaming at the top of our lungs about the unconstitutional nature of these bills, few took notice until the ACLU weighed in. Second, the ACLU is a very well-respected organization, particularly in liberal circles, and the fact that they have taken up this cause sends an important political message. Third, since the inauguration of President Trump and his attempts at instituting various rights-infringing policies, the ACLU has been a key institutional leader in opposing these policies, like the Muslim ban, for example. Once the ACLU weighed in, senators came under increased pressure to end their sponsorship of this anti-BDS legislation, and many have already expressed willingness to amend it or withdraw from it. It's not clear if this legislation would have ever come up for a vote. However, the legislation provided an opportunity to expose the repressive lawfare effort to a much wider audience. Now more people are becoming aware that Israel and its allies are actually trying to silence criticism of Israeli policy overseas. This very authoritarian tactic cuts against the ostensibly democratic ally Israel claims to be when it otherwise engages American audiences. Continuing to expose these repressive efforts in partnership with institutions that have been leaders in protecting free expression will be an important feature of our work moving forward. Lastly, we must work to build congressional support. We must work to build support in Congress for standing up for Palestinian rights. In recent years, we've seen important gains in this area, even though the energy of the movement has been more campaign-focused and not focused on the engagement of government. Last year, for example, 19 members of Congress signed a letter led by Representative Betty McCollum to the Secretary of State demanding steps be taken to protect Palestinian children whose rights are abused by Israeli policies. The letter even called for holding Israeli military units accountable under the Leahy Law, a provision which would deny aid or training to those units. This may seem unremarkable, but consider that 10 years ago, it was difficult to get even 5 members to sign a letter urging continued support for humanitarian aid to Gaza through UNRWA. Now we have 19 willing to sign on for conditioning aid. This year we worked on a similar letter calling for the protection of Isa Amro, a Palestinian rights defender who is being targeted by the Israeli military court system and is being forced to face trial on bogus charges. We were hoping we could get 25 names on a letter calling on the Secretary of State to advocate on his behalf and noting that the Israeli military courts are kangaroo courts with a 99% conviction rate. This advocacy campaign resulted in 34 members of Congress signing this letter. These numbers will continue to grow, and it is one of our main responsibilities to grow them. First, there will be letters, then there will be the introduction of legislation. Keep your eyes open for that very soon, and keep in mind, the first comprehensive sanctions bill for South Africa was introduced in 1972. It took 14 years before it could pass. But with unprecedented numbers of members taking steps to defy the intimidation of pro-Israel lobby groups, we find today the energy to redouble our efforts and continue to build. As their numbers grow, more numbers will feel safe in joining. We must work to build a core, first among progressive Democrats and then into the mainstream of American politics, that supports Palestinian rights, because Palestinian rights are as important as the rights of any other group. It's a long battle ahead, but it is a right battle. And I am proud and honored to play a role in it alongside so many of you around the world who want to see freedom, justice, and equality for us here in the United States and not last in Palestine. Thank you.
You have been listening to Yusuf Munayyer, Executive Director of the U.S. Campaign for Palestinian Rights, delivering the keynote address at the conference on the Balfour Declaration.
To BCFM's politics show with old Lady Broxford economist Martin Summers and me, Tony Gosling. The United Nations say the Yemen blockade must end or thousands will die. And Save the Children says 130 kids are dying every day in Yemen. We are supplying bombs, we are supplying personnel, and we are supplying aircraft to kill those people. by you and me, of course. It's the increasingly centralised powers in Westminster that are doing all this. In Turkey, we hear the Kurdish YPG is trying to conquer the whole of that part of Syria. And in Saudi Arabia, the king is to step down and crown his 32-year-old son as the new king. That's reports are saying that anyway today. And Israelis are saying that they're ready to share Iran intelligence with the Saudis, not just Iran, and other deals as well, no doubt. Maybe this new Saudi king will be an Israeli Saudi king. Also, fighting within ZANU-PF for succession, is it a coup or is it not a coup? And what, if any, is the role of the good old Pentagon, or AFRICOM for short? Getting ready for an epic war, starting with Iran, perhaps? Well, it's the Freemason and Confederate Captain Albert Pike's tune, his letter from the 1870s. We'll be having the final of two parts around about that this evening. Our sister show Dialect is on BCFM 93.2 here at noon every Tuesday. This week, Carol Higgins, an incredible struggle for justice after being sexually abused by her father, and a successful battle with cancer. She's an inspiration to us all. Plus, a little-known corner of the Lord Mayor's Chapel, opposite College Green. We have a look into some 16th-century Moorish influence on our city's architecture. Bet you didn't know about that. That's Dialect at noon next Tuesday. You can listen again at bcfmradio.com/dialect, or if you could download it too from dialectradio.co.uk. But Martin, let's start this week by having a look at this news from Saudi Arabia, with the possibility that the Saudi king will be stepping down and crowning his 32-year-old son as the new king. Are you surprised to hear that?
Well, no. I mean, MBS, as he is known, the new king, has been pretty much in charge for some time because his father is senile, not to put too fine a point on it.
His name's Mohammed bin Salman. You like calling him MBS.
MBS is apparently his nickname.
Why might the Israelis actually be interested in making him king? Power do they have to do that?
Well, it may or may not be news to our listeners. It shouldn't be that the Israeli right wing and the Saudi right wing have actually got a shared enemy in Iran, and they are basically on the same page, with us, of course. We're on their side too.
Okay, so the Persians are not really Arabs, but they're certainly all Muslims. How come Israel and the Muslim country of Saudi might be ganging up against other Muslims?
Well, because both Israel and Saudi Arabia are essentially Western-oriented puppet states. They are there to... they've got their own vested interest and their own ruling classes in both states, but those ruling classes are aligned with the United States and with Britain. And therefore, we're all on the same side, supposedly, to keep the masses in the Middle East in under the thumb, as they have been for several hundred years, and Britain has played a major role in that for all that time.
No, it's the Daily Mail that's reporting this. They say the King of Saudi Arabia plans to step down and announce his son as his successor next week. The move is seen as the final step in 32-year-old Prince Mohammed bin Salman's power grab, which began earlier this month, the arrest of more than 40 princes and government ministers and a corruption probe. The source said King Salman will continue only as a ceremonial figurehead, handing over official leadership to the country to his son, often referred to, as you quite rightly said, as MBS. Unless something drastic happens, King Salman will announce the appointment of MBS as King of Saudi Arabia next week.
Well, that's right. And he's also basically pushing for a war with Iran. People out there need to listen and understand the Israeli leadership and the Saudi leadership and the American leadership want a war with Iran. They're speaking about it in words of fire 10 feet high. I ask you, people listening to this show, do you want to go to war with Iran? because that's where our Conservative government is going to take us, because that's what all these other people want, and apparently we want it too. Do we want a war with Iran?
That is our democratically elected Conservative government, Mark.
That would be the one which hasn't actually got a mandate of 50% plus one of the vote. And, of course, that wouldn't be counted as a legitimate regime in some parts of the world.
The DUP have elected to join them, haven't they?
Yes, but even if you add the DUP votes to the Tory vote, it's still not 50% plus one, unlike every other European country, which has a different electoral setup. And, of course, it's not the case in the United States. Trump didn't get 50% plus one of the vote in the United States, but we're supposed to just accept that. Of course, if it was in Russia and Putin had less than 50% of the vote, we'd be saying that he was illegitimate. We're saying he's illegitimate anyway, or the mainstream are, even though he's got something like 80% of the vote. But when the two rice bowls clash, we'll see which one is fuller, because actually the Western system lacks legitimacy. And if you're going to have a world war, you've got to have the legitimacy. And of course, the government in Iran, the government in Russia, and probably the government in China have got more popular support than the Western leadership.
OK, antiwar.com is reporting Saudi Arabia is attacking Yemen, blockading the nation to a famine. They've also caused a regional row, a split with Qatar, and a threatening Lebanon. In its comments today, Saudi Foreign Minister Abdel Jubeir attributed every single action the Saudis have taken to Iranian aggression. Jubeir insisted this was obvious to everyone and that all Saudi actions have been their way of saying enough is enough to Iran. They believe, of course, that Iran has actually been interfering in Yemen, and that's why they had to go in there.
Well, they would say that, wouldn't they? Basically, the Saudis and the West and the Israelis have been provoking war from the get-go. And if ultimately, they may get the war they claim to want, but whether they can win it is another question, whether it's in Lebanon or in Iran.
OK, well, Haaretz today are also saying Israeli military chief is giving unprecedented interview to Saudi media, ready to share intelligence with Iran. So there is, if an intelligence sharing agreement, is that something that's been going
on with Saudi Arabia, not with Iran?
Iran, yeah. Sorry, yes. On Iran, yeah. So this is Israel and Saudi Arabia are in full agreement about Iran's intentions. Lieutenant General Gadi Eisenkot tells Elaf, noting that the two states have never fought each other. And the Saudi newspapers published an unprecedented interview on Thursday with his main military chief, Lieutenant General Gadi Eisenkot. It marks the first time that any senior Israeli Defence Forces officer, let alone the chief of staff, has been interviewed by a media organisation in Saudi Arabia, which doesn't actually have official diplomatic ties with Israel. In an interview, Eisenkot called Iran the real and largest threat to the entire region.
Well, they've basically been cooperating for years, and all we're seeing now is that cooperation coming into the open. Ultimately, for example, if the Israelis were to carry out a strike on Iran, they could fly to Saudi Arabia and carry out the strike from Saudi soil, and that's definitely been discussed. But both Israel and Saudi Arabia are not strong enough to fight Iran on their own. What they're going to do is provoke a war with Iran and then turn round to the Americans and us, the British, and say, oh, we're at war with Iran now. Can you help us out, please, because it's already started? And at that point, of course, the British should definitely say, no, you're on your own with this one.
OK, a couple of stories to do with ISIS, because we're seeing apparently the end game of the attacks on ISIS. One is a domestic one, Martin. It's in the Daily Express saying that Britons returning from ISIS territory do not justify prosecution, says the terror watchdog. Britons returning from ISIS territory don't justify prosecution, and that is in the Express. That, I mean, it does sound a bit strange, isn't it? If you're off fighting for ISIS, surely when you come back, you should at least face questioning. But the government's new independent reviewer of terrorist legislation, Max Hill QC, says the authorities have decided not to charge returnees. He said, we are told we do have a significant number already back in this country who have previously gone to Iraq and Syria. Now, the obvious question here, Martin, is what if these people start letting off bombs in Britain?
Well, the obvious question is, well, how did they get to Syria and Iraq in the first place? They were probably recruited by MI6, because ISIS, of course, is basically a Western front. Very interestingly, this week, the BBC have reported, can I just point this out, that at Raqqa, the Western-backed forces and the YPG, who we're probably going to cover in a moment, allowed thousands of ISIS fighters with weaponry to leave the city and disperse. because in actual fact, the Western powers support ISIS.
Martin, that's part of a peace agreement, surely.
No, listen.
They're saying, look, if we, you let us take the city and we'll let you go.
Yeah, but at the same time, they've been bombing the city indiscriminately and killing many civilians, so it's not about saving civilian life.
Okay, so they would say, militarily, we bombed them to the position where they are now, they've now agreed to leave the city.
Well, you could say that, but the deal leads to a situation where thousands of, and also, of course, what's been pointed out by the Iranians and the Russians, is that Des Azor, US helicopters came in and took out foreign leaders of ISIS to be redeployed elsewhere. The Iranian general staff, the Russian general staff and the Syrian general staff have been saying this all along, that ISIS is in fact a front organisation for Saudi Arabia and the West. So, and of course they are right.
So all this stuff with Peshmerga and also with Saudi Arabia in Israel starts to look as if this is the next stage of the game. Now ISIS is on its last legs.
That's right. Well, ISIS is basically a cat's paw that's deployed, like, you know, it's like a fox, and we breed foxes so that we can go tally-ho, there's a fox, and then we can intervene.
And now we're in a situation with US bases in Syria that the Russians have got to deal with.
Yeah, that's right. And of course, what the Kurds, the Kurdish forces, which are pressing on to try and take the oil fields in Syria, there's no Kurdish population in that area. But they're being pushed to take the oil fields to prevent the Syrian government from recapturing them. And of course, when ISIS carries out attacks in the West, because of their close links to the Saudis and Western intelligence services, we have to presume that those attacks are actually being carried out by our own intelligence services. That's what a serious police force, like the one in Italy, or possibly the one in Northern Ireland, would be starting to ask.
So what Reuters are saying is that recent developments in Syria's Raqqa show that the Kurdish YPG militia, backed by the United States, is more concerned about capturing territory than actually fighting Islamic State, the Turkish Foreign Minister Melvin Cavusoglu said in a speech yesterday. Turkey's expressed anger. A convoy of Islamic State fighters were allowed to withdraw from Raqqa last month as part of an agreement with the YPG, saying it was appalled by the US's stance on the issue. But, I mean, you could see this as a merciful act, couldn't you?
Well, you could, but it's interesting that the BBC have reported it, and it's been totally ignored in the media in the United States. If we're going to have a policy of allowing ISIS fighters to escape from certain places and take their weaponry with them, then we need to discuss whether that is our policy or not. Rather than just presume, that's what we've agreed. Now, what the Russians are contending is that the YPG and ISIS are actually cooperating. And that's also what the Turks are saying, as you've just said, which is pretty rich, really, because the Turks were major supporters of ISIS when they were aligned with Western policy.
Yeah,
until the YPG appeared, and then they
Until the coup attempt, surely. There's
yes,
been a whole
that's
switch.
Right.
You know.
That's right.
Actually, ISIS, the beginning of the end of ISIS was the Russian intervention, yes, but also the coup attempt.
Yes, and the Russians intervened in that to warn Erdogan and basically saved his life. Now,
can we just get back to the domestic stuff? Because I think this is what will be concerning most people out there. What are MI5 doing, saying it's okay for ISIS people to come back? We know exactly who they are, and they're not going to be prosecuted.
Well,
it's not a decision, apparently, that MI5 and others will have taken lightly, new terror watchdog Chappie,
yeah, but look,
Max Hill says, they, I am sure, will have looked intensely at each individual on return.
They looked intensely at them before they went out there, because at the Old Bailey a couple of years ago, a guy was put on trial for preparing to go to Syria to fight for a jihadist group, and he defended himself by saying, yes, but the group itself was orchestrated by MI6, and it was MI6 who recruited me. Now, this is the reason why they're allowed to come back, is because in actual fact they're on the payroll, and that most of the terrorism that's been carried out in the Western countries since 9/11 has been orchestrated by the intelligence services using Islamists as the front.
Okay,
and that's been the fact. That's just the basic pattern of what we're talking about.
Let's start talking about specific numbers. An estimated 850 Britons have reportedly travelled to Syria in the last 6 years, with 120 apparently killed in fighting. That leaves, 630. Half of those remaining are said to have already returned to the UK, but they won't be prosecuted.
No, because don't forget, the intelligence services would say, oh, we're just keeping an eye on them to see what they, you know, see what they lead us to, blah, 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 blah. But in actual
fact...
what
have they been being trained to do out in...
Well,
they've
probably been trained to do pretty similar to the Manchester bomber was trained to do, which is to actually build a viable bomb. And they've been he was trained to build a viable bomb, probably when he was in Libya, probably trained by somebody from Hereford who knows how to build viable bombs. That's the reality. As we go into World War III, and that's where we're going, Tony, people have got to face the facts that our intelligence services and special forces are the source of Islamist terrorism. The two things are absolutely linked, not just in Syria, where it's absolutely obvious, but also back here when attacks take place. And the police force have got to take a step back and start really investigating these incidents.
Oh, sorry, but they've just been cut. There are hardly any police left.
Indeed, and of course, as we all know, they are way down the food chain compared to the intelligence services. But if the police force don't get their finger out, and of course, in Italy, the police force did get its finger out. It took them decades, but they pointed the finger very firmly at NATO intelligence services as the source of terrorism.
OK, as this trouble spreads, now ISIS have been defeated to places like Saudi Arabia, to Yemen, also Lebanon. Lebanese Prime Minister has accepted an invite to France. Claims that Lebanese Prime Minister Saad Hariri is definitely not being held against his will in Saudi Arabia. Well, poppycock, I say. And he was going to return to Lebanon within 2 days. Absolute nonsense. Well, it definitely won't be coming to pass. Instead, Hariri is going to France.
That's because Macron went for a chat with MBS. And, of course, everybody's lining up now for this war with Iran in the Middle East, which I stress to our listeners, that's where we're going. Do you want a war with Iran? Because if you don't, you better start thinking about what you're going to do to stop it.
OK, what about the claims about Russia Today in Washington, which, bizarrely, I appeared on like a week before they started making a big, big fuss about it on the Sean Stone programme, Watching the Hawks, for 20 minutes or so. That actually does look as if now the Russians are starting to bite back, actually. They're naming 9 US-funded media outlets which will face foreign agents over in Russia. They've sent written notices to Voice of America and Radio Free Europe informing them that they will be affected by the Russian Parliament's new media law allowing for the labelling of certain foreign media as foreign agents.
Well, it's this sort of tit for tattery is the run-up to a world war. So that's what's happening.
We've had interviews on Newsnight and on the Daily Politics with people from RT. They're saying effectively that RT is in complete denial about the hacking of the US election, effectively spinning the US election and affecting elections. I mean, you're not going to try and deny, are you, that Russia does this kind of thing?
I am, because the evidence is, if there was any solid evidence, we would have seen it. And we haven't seen anything.
This week, Theresa May has also added her voice to saying that Russians are interfering in British general elections too.
Although she's rode back on that this very day, because in actual fact, as she saw in her Mansion House speech, she didn't give a single example of what she was talking about. And she said, well, I don't mean that they've interfered in Britain in the Brexit vote. I just mean that in general, they've interfered. And what they mean by interfered is Russia Today has acted like a news organisation reporting on elections, and that is interference as far as they're concerned.
Now, haven't the US a bit of a record of interfering in elections?
They do indeed.
The
National Endowment for Democracy in the United States will no doubt spend millions of taxpayer dollars in Russia in the run-up to the presidential election in March. They will fund the people they want, probably Alexei Navalny, to a very large extent. He won't win, but they will spend an awful lot of money to try and get him elected. And don't forget that Al Jazeera discovered that the Israeli government had spent £1 million inside the British Labour Party to try and control the policy.
Well,
that's the sort of thing that goes on out there.
They didn't say they'd spent £1 million. They said they had £1 million slush fund for anyone that was willing bring Israeli lobbying into the Labour Party through new lobby groups. Within the party.
Indeed. Now, the fact is that the Russians have got a fraction of the resources that the West has got. They obviously try and get their message out there. They obviously try and communicate, you know, their desires and wishes.
They've got a massive, they've got a massive military, and also Russia Today is an enormous network.
It's an enormous network.
Millions of viewers.
Yes, but it's got millions of viewers, but in terms of resources, it's absolutely minuscule compared to things like Sky News, for example, or Fox.
Which, by the way, are having financial trouble. The Murdoch Empire is, apparently.
Well, that's because all conventional media are being undermined by the revolution in internet technology and so on.
I mean, this classifying these as foreign agents, Radio Free Europe and Radio Liberty, there are 9 outlets apparently in Russia that are going to be are going to be affected by this, and they are all just different language versions, apparently, of Radio Free Europe, which targets various parts of the Russian Federation. Now, I mean, both sides are doing this. What's the problem?
Well, if both sides are doing it, both sides are doing it. Let's have no Queensbury rules, gloves off, and just punching. And on that basis, the Kiev snipers, the snipers that actually carried out the shootings in the Maidan Square at the beginning of the Ukraine crisis, they were in Il Giornale, which is an Italian newspaper this week, saying we were brought in from Georgia to shoot both police and protesters, and we were working for the current government, not the Yanukovych government, the current government. So in actual fact, the Western intelligence services killed those protesters on the Maidan Square. The Kiev snipers who did it have actually confessed this week in Il Giornale, which is an Italian newspaper. Is that going to be broadcast on the BBC, that we killed those people? Because, of course, the contention is that it was the pro-Russian government that had killed those people, but in actual fact, it wasn't them, it was us. It was us, and okay, of course the weaponry probably came from Britain, and the training was at Warsaw Police Academy.
There was some evidence actually on a BBC documentary about it that it was British weapons.
Yes,
anyway,
indeed.
Anyway, let's just quote from Il Journal. This article we'll put a link up to on our show page at thisweek.org.uk. Well, it's in Italian, so hopefully you'll have some translation system, not necessarily Google, the evil Google, to translate it for you. Everyone started shooting 2 or 3 shots at a time. It went on for 15 or 20 minutes. We had no choice. We were ordered to shoot both on the police and on the demonstrators without any difference. I was totally outraged. But, I mean, you know, how can a soldier say he's got no choice when he's ordered to shoot?
These were mercenaries brought in from Georgia, related to Shakashvili. Now, we don't know what we've always suspected that this was what took place, because Umas Piats, the Estonian foreign minister, gave a telephone call to Catherine Ashton, who was the EU's representative, and said, well, the information we're getting is that the snipers who killed these people were working for the new regime, not the old regime, the new regime. And of course, the new regime was working very closely with guess who? CIA, MI6. Those people that are supporting ISIS. The same stuff. And it's exactly the same plot and plan in every situation. It's create chaos and then use that chaos to try and advance your political goals. And it is terrorism by any definition. And it's our secret services who are the main perpetrators.
Also, looking over at the Asia-Pacific region, meeting with Japanese Defence Minister, the US Pacific Commander, Admiral Harry Harris, emphasised yesterday the role of America's massive military presence in the Pacific plays in any potential diplomatic efforts towards North Korea. Clearly, he said, while diplomacy must be the main effort with North Korea, it has to be diplomacy backed by credible military power, Harris insisted at the start of the meeting. That diplomacy is the main focus at all is something the US officials have been loath to admit. US idea of a credible military power, it seems, hinges heavily on threats to start a massive war unilaterally. So what is the strategy here? Is this just saber-rattling, or is there any real strategy?
I don't think they have got a real strategy, because once North Korea has got nuclear weapons, and it's perfectly logical why they've got nuclear weapons, it's the same logic why Britain's got nuclear weapons. It's just an insurance policy. And once they've got nuclear weapons, war is actually impossible unless you're going to have a nuclear war.
More about North Korea today. Apparently, North Korea's got a secret weapon. Kim Jong-un sets alarm bells ringing in the United States with shock pictures of some kind of special way of terrifying weapon of some sort to sink ships. I'm not quite sure exactly how it works. But, I mean, is this real? Is it propaganda? I mean, it does seem as if the North Koreans are generating stuff. I mean, we've seen before, haven't we, that in their military parades there have actually been ballistic missiles that are made of wood. So they're just trying to pretend, I guess.
Well, we don't know is the simple answer. But you've got to recognise that the era of the aircraft carrier is definitely over.
Well,
the US has a preponderance of aircraft carriers, but they are effectively just great big sitting targets in the modern era.
They're developing apparently powerful new submarines capable of firing deadly ballistic missiles from the sub.
Well, that's the same technology as we've got with Trident, and they're developing it for the same reasons we're developing it, just in case somebody attacks them. They won't dare, because we've got this, they're not relying on the Chinese nuclear umbrella, nor do we rely upon the US nuclear umbrella. That's why Britain has an independent deterrent, so-called.
How can we stop North Korea's aggressive building schedule?
We can't. North Korea has developed nuclear weapons, just like Pakistan, just like Israel, just like South Africa did, although they got rid of them. And once a country becomes a nuclear country, then that's it. You cannot attack them without starting a nuclear war. That's exactly why they've developed nuclear weapons. The logic of it is impeccable, because they haven't been, they agreed not to develop nuclear weapons in the 90s and started to build peaceful nuclear program and cooperate with the South. And that's how eventually you might have developed a dynamic to some kind of solution of that conflict.
Let's just have a look at two stories. I mean, we dealt already with this first one, which is Britain's, and the headline in the Daily Express was, Britain's returning from ISIS territory do not justify prosecution, says the terror watchdog. But on the other hand, there's an EU terror warning. The United States has issued winter travel alert amidst heightened threats in Europe. So how do we square these two?
It's quite straightforward, Tony. Basically, most of this so-called terrorist threat, particularly the Islamist terrorist threat, is orchestrated by Western intelligence services. They set up Al-Qaeda in the 1980s. They created ISIS, as General Flynn pointed out when he was interviewed. ISIS was created by the West. Al-Baghdadi met with John McCain when John McCain went to inside Syria. And so the main population are bombarded with propaganda about ISIS are out to get you, Al-Qaeda are the enemy, these terrible people are trying to blow you up. Oh, they have blown you up. But in actual fact, these organisations are orchestrated by the Western intelligence services, working very closely with the Saudis, bringing the circle back round again. Well, MBS.
We mentioned the media and this sort of media war between Washington and Russia. Also this week, a BBC journalist, this is reported by Middle East Monitor, has deleted her tweet about Britain's corrupt relationship with Israel. This is Laura Koonsberg, prominent BBC journalist, deleted a tweet in which a senior Tory MP can be seen complaining about the British media turning a blind eye to the corrupt relationship that has allowed Israel to buy access to Westminster. The tweet was posted by BBC's political editor Laura Koonsberg on Wednesday, while the Scottish journalist was covering the build-up to the resignation of Priti Patel. This is last week. The Secretary of State for International Development had taken part in undisclosed meetings in Israel organised by the powerful Conservative Friends of Israel lobby. The Twitter post on the day, which some bright sparks saved, she says, strong words. A senior Tory says Lord Pollack should be chucked out of the party, claiming the entire apparatus has turned a blind eye to a corrupt relationship that allows a country to buy access, referring to Israel. Strong words, she tweeted. But then she deleted her tweet.
Well, she's no doubt had her arm twisted up her back. Because that demonstrates the point that she made in the tweet itself, doesn't it?
The Middle East Monitor contacted Koonsberg to see why she deleted the tweet, but she didn't. They didn't get a reply. So it does seem as if there is this Israel lobby still, Martin, very powerful here in Britain. Mm-hmm. And, of course, that would be a decisive factor if it does come to a war with Iran and between Iran and Israel, and especially if Saudi Arabia weighs in as well, a great friend of ours, apparently, because they supply so much of our oil.
Well, I don't know if we get a lot of our oil from Saudi Arabia. They buy an awful lot of our weaponry, but that's another matter. I'm quite sure that the establishment in this country is definitely in the pocket of the Saudis and the Israelis. But I think the ordinary people in this country, A, haven't been warned that they're going to war with Iran, and B, there's no guarantee that they're going to support it. If the Tory government takes us to war with Iran to support Saudi Arabia and Israel, they deserve to be drummed out of office forthwith. And hopefully that's exactly what would happen.
In the meantime, we've heard this week that a homeless ex-soldier, 82 years old, has died hours after being evicted from his squat. This is reported in the Daily Mirror. A pretty horrific, Martin, that someone should be evicted aged 82, especially an ex-soldier. And I just wonder... it says other homeless ex-servicemen took the man, known only as George, to hospital, but he passed away with them at his bedside. I mean, he was basically found just lying in the street.
Well, we were talking about universal credit in the first hour, and all the evidence shows that introduction of universal credit will massively increase homelessness. Massively. Because lots of people will simply fall into rent arrears and be evicted. Just as you said in the run-up to Christmas, is a fantastic Christmas present for the poorest people in the country from our glorious government, eh?
So what's the solution to the homelessness problem?
Well, the obvious thing to do, and what we should have been doing since 1979, is building social housing at affordable rents for lower-income people.
George had been living in a disused building in Manchester with 12 other homeless ex-servicemen before they were all evicted. Well, that's, a couple of those, and you've got a platoon. Maybe they could fight back and actually get themselves somewhere permanent.
Well, the long-run solutions, as we know, are to provide low-cost housing. In the short run, of course, squatting should be decriminalised and people should be recognised for doing what they're doing as a necessity, because there isn't anywhere else for them to go.
Is there anything we could do in Bristol, do you think, particularly to make sure that particularly the elderly are not just... I mean, this guy was 82 years old and not just left homeless?
Well, the obvious thing to do is, A, as we're saying, is to try and build more low-cost housing, decriminalise squatting so that if people need to squat, then they can without being persecuted, and also, of course, support the charities which are doing their best to try and help the people at the bottom of the pile. But it's things are going to get worse before they get any better, aren't they?
Councils are sending the bailiffs around 2 million times in a year. It doesn't sound like Bristol City Council, if they're part of this, are paying any attention to you at all. That's another Daily Mirror article, which also includes your rights if one turns up at your door. Unpaid council tax and parking fines and rent resulted in more than 2 million bailiffs being sent to people's homes.
Well, that was one of the reasons why they didn't introduce council tax or poll tax in Northern Ireland, because during the census in the 1970s, people who went round just to collect the census were assassinated. And, of course, you can imagine private sector bailiffs turning up on the Falls Road to take away people's tellies. They're likely to end up dead in a ditch. And, of course, once you've got the rate... During the rates era, bailiffs weren't involved in collecting rates. Rates are very simple to collect. If a property which owes the rates doesn't pay the money that it's owed, the property is impounded. The bailiffs don't have to get involved. Bailiffs are only used to chase poor people for small amounts of money. And, of course, they couldn't bring that in Northern Ireland, either on the Falls or the Shankill Road, because anybody who tried to take away people's tellies would end up dead.
This horrifying division between rich and poor is put into sharp focus this week, as Oxfam has said the world's 8 richest people have the same wealth as the poorest 50%.
Well, that's right, and that's largely to do with the QE policies that have been pursued since the crash, which allow free money to be printed by governments, which is then given to banks, private banks, which is then used to push asset prices up.
Well, a lot of this is coming in share dividends, isn't it?
Yeah, that's right. Well, of course, because the stock market's being goosed up with public resources, which, of course, is not supposed to happen. It's completely against the textbook, but, hey, the textbook's in the race paper basket.
The Guardian puts it this way, similar thing. It's Bill Gates, Jeff Bezos, I've never heard of, and Warren Buffett, who I have. The three of them are all wealthier than the poorest half of America.
Well, that's right, and this has been going on for decades now. The creation of a super elite who are way, what should have happened in 2008 when the system collapsed is they should have been allowed to lose all their money. But, of course, you can't do that because then capitalism has to end, and we can't end capitalism. So the taxpayer, the ordinary punters, have to stump up and sacrifice so that the multi-billionaires can get even more, can get even wealthier. But at a certain point, of course, the tumbrils roll and the guillotines come out.
To protect John Redwood's job as an investment manager, he warned his wealthy clients to get their money out before disaster hits. Now, this, I think, is relating to Brexit, isn't it?
Yep.
Even though he's a major Brexiteer, saying get your money out.
Well, as a politician, Redwood is constantly pushing the idea that Brexit is going to be a great success, and that people who are down saying it are just undermining the Britain, blah, blah, blah. But as a fund manager in the city, he's saying, get your money out now, because Britain's going to crash. You couldn't make it up, could you?
Also, Philip May, the Prime Minister's husband, has questions to answer, apparently, over the Paradise Papers. His company is linked to investments made via offshore tax havens in the Paradise Papers. So this is this company he's one of the major partners in, Philip May, who's a strange character. I think we had a programme not long after Theresa May came to power where we had his laugh on the programme, which was a very strange kind of almost like a robotic laugh. And he was saying, he's saying effectively that this, it's called Capital Group, based in Los Angeles, with investments in companies like Starbucks and Lockheed Martin.
Yes, and is it any wonder that our glorious Prime Minister is less than enthusiastic about closing down tax havens when her husband is a major seller
Who's in charge? Who's wearing the trousers? Surely he just tells her what to do.
I think that was that's a slightly sexist remark.
Why? Martin, that's not sexist. I think he's the one with a much more powerful financial interest in what happens at number 10.
I would just suggest this. It's pretty obvious there's a conflict of interest there. I'll say no more than that.
Labour has said Theresa May's husband, Philip, has serious questions to answer about his firm's links to possible tax avoidance. Private Eye has seen emails that suggest Mr. May's company, Capital Group, used an offshore law firm called Appleby to arrange investments for clients in tax havens. Documents suggest they have funds registered in the Cayman Islands, which were used to investments in South American agriculture company called El Tejar. The Shadow Minister for Cabinet Office, John Trickett, said there's some serious questions Philip May to answer, but of course he won't be answering them, Martin, will he?
And if he doesn't answer them, then politically, I hope the government pays the price. You don't have to say anything, and anything you do say may be taken down and used as evidence against you.
Local MP, Conservative MP Jacob Rees-Mogg, North Somerset, says we must give the National Health Service £350 million a week post-Brexit. Now, what he's saying is that this promise that was made on the bus must be upheld.
Well, it'd be interesting to see if that happens, because in actual fact they haven't got £350 million to give it, because the fact is that we're not going to get that money back from Brussels any time soon. They could spend the money anyway, but then they'll have to give up the fantasy that they're reducing the deficit.
So it's a bit of
a no-win situation for them, isn't it?
What's behind this comment from Rees-Mogg, if you think it's not possible anyway?
Well, I think what he's doing is he's politicking in terms of internal fights inside the Tory party. They're trying to make life as difficult as possible for people like Hammond. I understand Michael Gove fancies his chances as Chancellor of the Exchequer. So they're basically on the bridge. The officer class are stabbing each other in the back and in the front. Meanwhile, the ship is sinking.
Carl Sargent over in Wales was not given a natural justice, his family said. This is the poor Welsh politician, Labour politician, who committed suicide about 10 days ago. He was found dead after being sacked from the cabinet and suspended from Labour. Now, there are some pretty shocking pictures of the celebrations that went on by the cabinet and the Welsh Labour cabinet in Cardiff when his sacking was announced, Martin.
Well, I don't know whether...
Basically, he's a Corbynista and they're very pleased they've got rid of him. And then he committed suicide.
Well, the whole thing is extremely sad. If he was involved in bad behaviour, that's reprehensible. But I don't think anybody deserves to die for carrying out sexual harassment.
It's not proportionate, is it? Making this whole thing entire thing public without actually telling him what he's alleged to have done.
Well, that's what his family are saying. And I think what's required here, and I think Jeremy Corbyn has said this, we need to look at our procedures for dealing with this thoroughly. There's got to be people who complain of sexual harassment should be treated with absolute seriousness. It's an incredibly serious allegation, and it's to be treated with a complete seriousness. But on the other hand, people also have to be treated as innocent till proven guilty. Otherwise, we don't know.
But he was sacked.
Yeah, we haven't. This is the issue about the procedure, isn't it? If you're going to, he was suspended. He wasn't sacked. as I understand it.
No, he was sacked, and he should have been suspended. That's
And it
was seen as an opportunity for a Blairite Labour administration to get rid of a Corbynite from North Wales.
If that is the case, then that is reprehensible, Tony, but I don't know enough about the case to wade in. We've got to see natural justice done, both to people who complain of being harassed and to those who are complained against.
What about all these claims of bullying there have been by the Carwyn Jones, the Welsh leader?
I have no comment to make because I haven't the faintest idea whether they're true or not. If they are true, then that's reprehensible.
Also, will UK banks be sharing your details with organised crime? This is a fascinating story in the Mail. Fears are growing that open banking will increase the threat of fraud. Massive shake-up is going to force banks to share their financial details with third parties. Concerns are growing. Cyber criminals will exploit the new banking rules. Companies will be held accountable and banks will pay refunds if customers dispute a payment. Now, well, this is talking about a new era of banking which will be ushered in from January next year. Security experts say it will put people at much greater risk of scams and identity theft. Under the new open banking rules, Britain's biggest banks will be forced to share customer data with companies that demand it. Providers of other payment accounts, such as credit cards, some savings accounts, will have to do the same under European Union legislation. As part of the second Payment Services Directive, something called PSD2. Some banks have already sent letters to customers warning third parties will be able to access their personal data from January.
Well, I mean, this is the first I've heard of this story, but increasingly we live in an Orwellian world, do we not, where we are being constantly monitored and observed, but we don't know by who, and we don't know to what ends.
Why might they be doing this, since this will aid identity thieves?
I've no idea, Tony.
Also, there is a kind of move towards and away from cash and towards electronic banking. The Financial Conduct Authority apparently will be governing these organisations that these details are being shared with. But do you have any confidence in the regulators, the city regulators we've got?
No, and of course the drive to get rid of cash is part of the crisis. Because if you've got to keep your money in a bank, that helps to prop the banks up. And, of course, they've tried to introduce, get rid of cash in India, the Narendra Modi right-wing regime in India, which Priti Patel is pretty close. She's supported Narendra Modi's policy of trying to get rid of cash. But in India, where the vast majority of the population don't have bank accounts, many of them don't even have electricity, it's a completely absurd policy, which has caused enormous suffering. But it's part of a general policy being pursued throughout the world by the financial elite to basically make sure that we are all in their field of fire. They will control us. If they control the electronic money and you can't get electronic money without going to them, then they control the population, and that's the strategy.
Blacklisted News, I rather like. They this week had one of their tweets and one of their articles on their website. Is America becoming a police state where churches can't feed the homeless and kids can't set up lemonade stands? And they're quoting various incidents where people have been either harassed by the police and told that they've got to take their places where they're giving away free food down, or arrested. Some of them even jailed for just handing out food.
Well, I mean, we're moving towards a social conflagration. It's been coming since 2008 and the so-called crash bailout, whatever it was. And, things are finally coming to a head.
Just one example. In Porterville in California, in this article, fascinating article on Blacklisted News, a five-year-old girl who set up a lemonade stand to raise money to buy herself a new bike was told 4 months later that she needed a business license to do it. Her mother received a warning and a citation from City Hall, which told her she had to send back $59, a local fee for applying for a new license, plus a fine.
Well, that's very reprehensible, but it's minor stuff. Much more important is
what
the
I'm saying
attempt
is the thin end of the wedge, isn't it?
Yeah.
Isn't this actually what seems to be happening? Look, let's just take a step back from stories like that. Is that local authorities, in this case a city council in the United States, are turning into businesses, and there's people sitting there thinking, how can we make money? Any way we can make money, let's try and do it. And that's just another example.
Well, they're also, even if they're not being businesses, they're like Bristol City Council. They've got to try and raise money from somewhere to pay for the things that they want to do, because they've got no resources. So the public realm is being denuded of resources, and the private realm, or the realm of private interests, are being goosed up with public resources. And this has been going on for quite a long time now, and we're now reaching the apogee of this policy.
Well, just looking at the Blacklisted News website tonight, their headline is, "The world's first human head transplant has been successfully carried out in China." In an 18-hour operation that showed it was possible to successfully reconnect the spine, the nerves and the blood vessels. Pretty gory stuff. But, I mean, this is... It was another era. People would have just said, this is unethical, we're not going to allow you to do it.
Well, if you think about it, a head transplant basically is putting... It's actually a body transplant for the head, isn't it? It's the head that's being rescued. The body doesn't... The body is being put onto is there to preserve the head, I presume, rather than the other way
around. Actually, it says... I mean, sorry, we shouldn't be laughing, really. This is from the Daily Telegraph. The world's first human head transplant was carried out on a corpse in China. So it's not all live.
Well, so it's not really that... That's not really that helpful, is it?
Well, yes, but what are they... I mean, they're experimenting with this in order to try and get to do it on live human beings.
Well, I mean, it's not necessarily stupid. It might be useful at some point, but it's not, you know... I just don't know enough about it to have a strong opinion.
Okay, so let's have a listen now to... have a little look at something which I was going to listen to in the first hour, we didn't have time to, which is HS2. And here is Dennis Skinner from a couple of weeks ago at Prime Minister's Questions asking about the rail project.
Dennis Skinner. Is the Prime Minister aware there's been some very powerful research done on the question of high-speed rail? What it says is that in the leafy suburbs of the south, the first 140 miles, 30% of it has been dedicated to tunnelling to avoid knocking houses down. Yet in the north, we are now told that the percentage is only 2% for the whole of the north.
So not
why?
Ours, though.
Because HS2 says it's too costly, knock the houses down. Will she arrange for a meeting with people from my area in order to avoid another 30 houses being knocked down in Newton, part of Bolsover? And isn't it high time that this government stop treating our people like second-class citizens?
I say to the Honourable Gentleman that I'm sure the Department of Transport will be happy to look into the question that he has raised. But of course, HS2, the reason why we're doing HS2 is that it is important to increase the capacity of the railway lines going through to the north. This will be a very important contribution to the United Kingdom economy. And I can assure him, if he looks at everything that this government has done with the Northern Powerhouse, the Midlands Engine, the... The significant investment across in infrastructure across all parts of the country. This is a government that wants to ensure this is a country that works for everyone.
Now, it's Theresa May, the Prime Minister, replying to Dennis Skinner, the Labour Party member for Bolsover's question about HS2. Martin, the news is this week that HS2 will be the most expensive railway on earth at £403 million a mile.
Yeah, I'm not a big fan of HS2. And, of course, what all it does really is if the conception of it is wrong. It's connecting the undeveloped north to the developed south. Whereas, obviously, what I would suggest is that the money should be spent is in creating rail infrastructure in the north.
Well, reopening. So, how about reopening rail infrastructure?
Yeah, well, you know, the if you want to actually help the north...
Or subsidising rail travel to cut down on congestion. But then we won't be able to have a congestion charge.
No, well, that's... The congestion charge is a red herring in this context, I would suggest to you. The problem is...
£111 billion, apparently, this is really going to cost. This is one of the latest accurate estimates.
Yeah, but all that will happen is that people will be able to move more quickly down to London to do. You know, the idea is that connecting the north to London directly by HS2 will benefit the north. It's just as likely to suck resources from the north down to London. It makes much more sense to me to upgrade the rail infrastructure from, say, Manchester to Leeds.
Well, Manfred Petrich, we're going to hear from him next week on HS2. We'll have to leave that till next week. But he's suggesting that for that money, you can build a railway all the way around the world. And I don't know. I mean, it does seem so utterly corrupt, this HS2 project. Anyway, let's leave that for now, because we're going to go back to the Albert Pike story. And this is continued from last week from a chap called Jean-Pierre de Smet, who's from South Africa. And here he talks about World War III with atheists versus nihilists.
Now, how were they going to do it? Let's read what Albert Pike wrote about these wars and how they were going to be unleashed. He wrote, quote, "We shall unleash the nihilist and the atheist," so the destroyer and the atheist, "and we will provoke a formidable social cataclysm which, in its horror, will show clearly to the nations the effect of absolute atheism. Origin of savagery and the most bloody turmoil. Then everywhere the citizens obliged to defend themselves against the minority of revolutionaries will exterminate these destroyers of civilization, and the multitude, disillusioned with Christianity, will receive the pure light through the universal manifestation of the pure doctrine of Lucifer. The destruction of Christianity and atheism, both conquered and exterminated at the same time." Wow, what a clever plan. So you rub the two systems which you create up against the other. You create atheism as an antithesis to the Judeo-Christian culture. You have these two clash until they rub each other up. And then out of that, you will get a new world order where you have a new religion which is far more esoteric and actually honors Satan. Isn't that a rather clever plan?
So that's Jean-Pierre de Smet there. I'll put a link up to the Daily Express article about the Albert Pike letter. Not saying it's true, just a fascinating way of taking a step back from history and looking at what might be going on with all these world wars. And it's time to sign off now for the Murdoch News at 7. Coming up live on Facebook, Arabian Nights with Mohammed Makawi. Thanks to our guest in the first hour. That was National Health Service Finance Manager and Labour Party member Esther Giles. Her event is going on just next to All Hallows Hall, All Hallows Street here in Easton at 1 o'clock tomorrow, looking at the city's budget and, in fact, all the core cities across the country. Also, thanks to old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers. This show's story links and comment page is onewordthisweek.org.uk. You can download our MP3s and you can listen in the car, iPlayer, or anywhere you like. You'll find me on Twitter at Tony Gosling. Here's wishing you a relaxing and enjoyable weekend. I'll leave you with music from 1983 from Rufus and Chaka Khan. Do please join us for the politics show at the same time next week. God bless, and don't let the banksters get you down. Thank you.
Welcome to the Project Censored Show. I'm Mickey Huff. On today's program, we're going to spend the hour looking at the perils of nuclear power, nuclear energy, and citizen science and activism. We are joined, the first part of the program, by filmmaker Robbie Lepser. We'll be talking about his new film, Power Struggle. Later in the program, we're joined by Fair Winds Energy Education experts, Arnie and Maggie Gunderson, who will give us an update on what's been going on in Fukushima. Stay with us.
Political ties, habitualized alibis, skies, another guise of democracy, politics, and the apocalypse. Got the skies looking ominous.
Welcome to the Project Censored Show. I'm Mickey Huff. On today's program, we're going to be looking at nuclear power, the perils of nuclear energy. We'll have an update on Fukushima. But for the first part of the program, we are joined by Robbie Lepser. We're going to talk about his recent movie, Power Struggle. Robbie Lepser is an award-winning independent documentary filmmaker and radio producer. His critically acclaimed feature-length and short documentaries, along with television news magazine segments, have been broadcast by CNN International, NHK, Japan Broadcasting Corporation, the Canadian Broadcasting Corporation, HBO, PBS, Sundance Channel, and many, many more, including National Public Radio, Free Speech TV, and Pacifica Radio. Robbie Lepser, welcome to the Project Censored Show.
Thank you so much for having me, Mickey.
And again, we'll likely be having many more conversations with you given your long and illustrious career of activism and filmmaking. But on today's show, we're focusing on nuclear power, nuclear energy, fallout from Fukushima. And of course, this overlaps quite well with your Power Struggle movie. But let's talk a little bit about how you got into this kind of activism.
Well, in terms of Power Struggle itself, I live 18 miles from Vermont Yankee. And so if there was ever to be a release, a major release of radioactivity from the plant, my community would be affected. So I became concerned and wanted to do something. I've had a long history of making documentaries chronicling social change movements. And I've been following, from a distance at least, the movement over the years to shut down Vermont Yankee. So when I heard that Vermont was the only state in the country whose legislature was empowered to make a decision about the future operation of a nuclear power plant, I thought, as a documentary filmmaker, that it would be fascinating to follow the process of citizens engaged in raising their voice about an issue they feel passionate about, in this case, the future of energy and the safety of their communities. And I had no idea what the outcome would be, or that I would spend 5 years making the film.
Wow, 5 years in the making, and so much has actually happened in the 5 years during the making of the film, I'm sure.
A lot happened. Basically, the grassroots citizen movement in Vermont decided to focus on the state legislature and their elected state officials. They had become so frustrated with the federal government and the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, which is the federal agency in charge of regulating nuclear power plants. They felt that that was hopeless, but they did have felt they had a chance to have an impact on the state level. So that's where they decided to focus their efforts, and they did have a big impact.
Well, Robbie Lepser, later on in the program, we're going to be joined by nuclear energy experts Arnie Gunderson and Maggie Gunderson of Fair Winds Energy Education. And, of course, you not only know them, but they're actually featured in the film Power Struggle.
Yes, I actually met Arnie and Maggie Gunderson while I was filming Power Struggle. In fact, I met them very early on in the process. I started filming when I heard that there was going to be a walk of activists from Brattleboro in the southern part of Vermont to Montpelier, the state capital. And this was going to be 126 miles over 11 days. And this is the key punchline, in the dead of winter. So that's when I began filming, because I thought, wow, to film people walking through Vermont through snow and ice, which really showed the dedication of people. And I thought, well, I would film this, and then I put the footage on the shelf, because nobody knew when the Vermont legislature was going to vote. But little did I know that events had other plans for me. Literally, it was halfway through the walk. The activist hadn't even made it to the state capitol, was when Entergy, the power company that runs Vermont Yankee, and is in fact the second largest nuclear power company in America, announced that there was a massive leak of radioactive tritium, as well as other radioactive isotopes, into the groundwater below Vermont Yankee. And that started a whole political firestorm, not only about the contamination, but then Entergy was caught in a lie. A lie because the year earlier, Entergy had denied under oath to the Public Service Board of Vermont that there was underground pipes containing radioactivity. And now, when the leak happened, they had to say, oh, by the way, this leak came from these pipes that we formerly denied existed. And the connection with Arne Gundersen is that Arne Gundersen is the nuclear engineer turned whistleblower who revealed this leak, who uncovered it, and I was filming him testifying in the Vermont legislature, and that's when I immediately recognized that he and his wife Maggie would play a prominent role in my film.
Indeed, rightfully so. Arne and Maggie Gundersen of Fairwinds Energy Education have been on the Project Censored Show numerous times, and again, they'll be on later after our segment here with you, Robbie Lepser. And you are of Turning Tide Productions, so our listeners can go to turningtide.com to learn more about your work. And also, powerstrugglemovie.com is where listeners can find out more about your film. So, Robbie Lepser, here is the trailer to your film. This is the film trailer for Power Struggle.
The chain reaction process in the reactor creates tremendous heat, which scientists have learned how to control.
It was really a patriotic thing to harness the atom. I was excited about nuclear engineering because I thought it would solve the world's energy crisis. When everything works, they're really a terrific way of making energy. The problem is that everything doesn't work all the time.
Japan's nuclear nightmare continues. A second hydrogen explosion at the Fukushima Daiichi nuclear complex destroyed the reactor's exterior. All three Daiichi reactors have nuclear fuel rods that have been exposed to some degree. So they're teetering on the edge of a meltdown.
Fukushima, it kind of stirred everybody to the reality of what nuclear power could do.
There is no source of energy in this world that doesn't have risk associated with it. Our job is to protect public health and safety and never have an accident that jeopardizes public health or safety.
Groundwater down there is being threatened, and potentially the river water is being threatened.
Something needs to be done right now. I believe that plant is unsafe.
What has happened at Vermont Yankee is a breach of trust that cannot be tolerated.
We were now being lied to.
We have a lot of explaining to do, and we have to rebuild public confidence and trust. We're operating a nuclear power plant.
How can you trust a company who has really not taken seriously, in my opinion, the fact that we have leaking nuclear waste going into the ground?
Einstein said that nuclear power is a hell of a way to boil water.
It is toxically poisonous to humans for 250,000 years. I keep saying that number, 250,000 years. It's ridiculous. It's mind-boggling.
That was the film trailer for Power Struggle, and we're talking with filmmaker Robbie Lepser. So, Robbie Lepser, let's talk a little bit more about the film and Arne Gundersen.
When I first met Arne and Maggie Gundersen, I was totally impressed with their story and their backstory, because they were insiders in the nuclear industry for 20 years, Arne as a nuclear engineer, Maggie as a PR person in the nuclear industry, and In the film, I actually devote a whole segment of the film to telling the story of what happened to Arnie and Maggie back in 1990, when Arnie became an unwitting whistleblower in the nuclear industry when he reported a safety violation at his nuclear energy services company in Connecticut. And he thought he was just doing his job reporting the safety violation, and the company turned around and fired him and then blacklisted him from the industry and then sued him for $1.5 million on top of all of that. So they suffered greatly. So to me, Maggie and Arnie Gunderson are my personal heroes because they have been speaking truth to power for decades despite the nuclear industry's attempt to silence them. Now, fast forward now 20 years, they move to Vermont, and they become involved in Vermont Yankee issues, and then the state of Vermont, the Vermont legislature, hires Arnie to be their nuclear watchdog in reevaluating the license for Vermont Yankee, whether it can be renewed for 20 years. And so Arnie was chairing a panel for the Vermont legislature overseeing the future reliability of Vermont Yankee, and that's when he uncovered the issue of the underground pipes and that Entergy had lied about. So he became very prominent in that whole controversy, and before that was revealed publicly by Entergy, Entergy actually tried to smear Arnie again and saying that he was a crackpot or had an axe to grind, but then there was all egg over Entergy's face when they actually had to admit that Arnie was right and that they had in fact lied and that there had in fact been underground pipes.
We also have a couple other clips from your film, and as you stated, you feature not just Arnie and Maggie Gunderson, but many other people, but perhaps we can also hear a clip of Arnie Gunderson talking about Fukushima connected to the Vermont Yankee safety flaws.
Arnie in the film reveals that Fukushima and Vermont Yankee have the same exact design and the same exact design flaws. And he goes into detail in this clip.
Okay, here's a clip from the movie Power Struggle by Robbie Lepser, and this features Arnie Gunderson.
In the United States, there's 23 General Electric Mark I reactors identical to Fukushima Daiichi. Vermont Yankee came online almost identical time to Fukushima Daiichi Unit 1. They have the same design. They're the same reactor, same contractors worked on them, and the same flaws and weaknesses. The containment structure designed to hold in all the radioactivity after an accident is too small. By 1986, the Nuclear Regulatory Commission had determined there was an 85% probability that the containment would blow up and fail in the event of a meltdown. So much hydrogen gas would be released that the containment would be blown to smithereens and all of the radioactivity inside it would be released to the public. Fukushima showed us 100%, three of them blew up. The regulators have known that this design is incapable of withstanding an accident since it was built. During the middle of the crisis at Fukushima Daiichi, one of the key regulators at the NRC, a guy named Chuck Casto, said, "This is the worst containment in the world." Well, if it's the worst containment in the world, why are we keeping 23 of them running here in America? The accident at Fukushima Daiichi was caused by an earthquake and a tsunami. But really, at the root of it was that the earthquake knocked out the offsite power and that the tsunami knocked out the cooling water pumps along the ocean. That can happen anywhere. You can lose offsite power from a storm or from a terrorist action, and you can lose the pumps that cool the plant from the same exact causes. So we don't need a tsunami, we don't need an earthquake to cause that kind of a damage in an American nuclear plant.
That was another clip from a new movie called Power Struggle by Robbie Lepser. You can learn more at powerstrugglemovie.com. And Robbie Lepser, you chronicle many other people and struggles during the film itself. So talk to us a little bit more about what's going on in the film.
Grassroots groups have been opposing Vermont Yankee since the plant was built, starting in 1972. So there's been a whole decade of struggle in Vermont around Vermont Yankee. I started filming in 2010, and Power Struggle, my documentary, really focuses on this movement from 2010 forward. And there was a whole coalition of various groups across the state and also in western Massachusetts. And one of the activists that I focus on in my film is Frances Crowe, who was 93 years old when I first started filming her. She's actually 98 years old now and still going strong. And she was part of an affinity group called the Shut It Down Affinity Group, which was all women over 60 who would regularly go to Vermont Yankee and chain the gates shut or blockade the gates, commit civil disobedience in front of the plant.
That's an incredible story in and of itself. And we actually have a clip of Frances Crowe from your movie. It's a short clip, so perhaps we can play that now.
I'm Frances Crowe. I'm 93 years old, and I've been involved in trying to say no to the splitting of the atom and all of the consequences of it since 1945. When I heard about Fukushima, I was devastated. I felt I've got to get there and really put my body at Vermont Yankee, because it's our potential Fukushima. Well, I've done everything that I know of to do, and all I have left is my body, and to put it in the way to say no.
I'd like to remind listeners, you're listening to the Project Censored Show. I'm Mickey Huff. We've been interviewing filmmaker Robbie Lepser. His new movie is Power Struggle. You can learn more about Robbie Lepser at his site, TurningTide.com, and learn more about the movie at PowerStruggleMovie.com. Robbie Lepser, let's talk about what also this film is about. It's about grassroots activism around these issues surrounding nuclear energy. What do you think, and what did you find, the impact of this activism?
Well, I feel that the grassroots activists had an enormous impact in terms of the outcome of what happened with Vermont Yankee. In the summer of 2013, Entergy, the company that operates Vermont Yankee, announced that they were going to be closing Vermont Yankee a year and a half later in December of 2014. They claimed at the time that the reason for closing Vermont Yankee was solely because of finances and economics, that the plant was losing money. However, the grassroots activism and the involvement of the Vermont state officials had an enormous impact in pushing Vermont Yankee over the edge that led to its eventual closure. And as you know, a story of grassroots activists, particularly grassroots environmental activists, having a victory is very rare these days. So Power Struggle chronicles what I feel is a very inspiring story of activists actually winning and actually having a major impact that other activists around the country on a variety of issues could learn from and could be inspired from.
And naturally, a film of not just your genre, but the magnitude and the breadth of it. And you talked about making it over a period of 5 years. That's your contribution in terms of activism. And it's very important, given that these grassroots movements usually don't get coverage in corporate media, that they really rely on citizen journalism, on filmmakers, other activists that can really propel that message and get that message out to the public. And certainly that's something that you've been doing for a very long time.
Well, I got a very early start when I was 18 and have really dedicated myself as a documentary filmmaker to chronicle grassroots movements because, as you just said, the mainstream corporate media really ignores them or gives very scant or distorted coverage to. So I feel like for me to focus my work on grassroots movements and really showing how people can inspire each other to be a force for change in the world is my contribution as a filmmaker to make a better world.
Well, it's an incredible contribution, what you're doing, Robbie Lepser. you highlight and showcase something that is a victory to celebrate for grassroots activists and certainly for people interested and concerned about the state of our environment, not just with climate change, but also the issues surrounding nuclear energy, nuclear power, and of course, by extension, nuclear warfare, which is still a very real problem that seems to oft get overlooked or ignored. But, you know, another thing that's also been disappeared into the rearview mirror is the catastrophe in Fukushima in Japan and the fallout from that. Could you talk a little bit about some of the consequences?
Well, one thing that many people don't realize, because it's just not on people's radar, is that nuclear power plants produce the most toxic poisons that will stay dangerous for a quarter of a million years. That's 250,000 years. And the sad reality is that, so my film, Power Struggle, has kind of a double ending. On the one hand, it's a victory of grassroots activism and showing the power of people to make change. On the other hand, the reality is that high-level radioactive nuclear waste is going to stay at the Vermont Yankee site and every nuclear power plant site across the country and around the world indefinitely, because there's no place to put that high-level nuclear waste. And so this is an issue that we as a society have to grapple with.
Indeed, Robbie Lepser. And I'd like to also remind listeners, you're listening to the Project Censored Show. I'm Mickey Huff. And upcoming, we're going to air an interview that was pre-recorded with Arnie Gunderson and Maggie Gunderson. And they have some updates from Fukushima, Japan. And they're going to be talking to us about some of the serious problems with soil samples, as well as warn us about some future dangers about decommissioning and the ways in which it might be planned to get rid of nuclear plants that's actually very, very worrisome and troublesome.
Well, what I would add about that is pay attention to what happens with Vermont Yankee. The plant is closed, but the real danger or the next level of danger is coming up with how Entergy, again, who is the second largest nuclear power company in America, is planning to decommission this plant. And they're proposing some processes that could set a precedent in terms of creating new public health threats that would endanger the surrounding communities in how they dismantle the plant.
And I would certainly encourage our listeners to look at the work of Robbie Lepser and TurningTide.com. This film that we've been talking about, sharing a few clips with you about, is called Power Struggle, and the website is PowerStruggleMovie.com. And I'd also like to tell listeners that we're certainly going to have Robbie back on the Project Censored show, but also coming up in 2018 in the spring, we're very hopeful that, Robbie, you'll be out in California, and you're going to be traveling the country, and our show airs around the country, but you're going to also be out here on the West Coast, hopefully, and we'll be able to show some screenings of the film.
Yes, I very much want to do that, because my whole reason for making films is for these documentaries to be used as discussion catalysts and for catalysts to inspire renewed activism.
Well, Robbie Lepser, thank you so much for joining us today on the Project Censored show. We definitely look forward to sharing your work, your film, and we'll certainly have you back on the program in the near future.
Thank you so much, Mickey. It's been a great pleasure talking with you.
This is the Project Censored Show. I'm Mickey Huff. Coming up next is our interview with Arnie and Maggie Gunderson. They are of Fair Winds Energy Education. After that, we'll also hear from Poets Reading the News, so please stay with us. Welcome back to the Project Censored Show. I'm your host, Mickey Huff. In this segment of the program, we are going to be joined by the good people at Fairwinds Energy Education, fairwinds.org, FAIREWINDS.org. Listeners of the Project Censored Show will recognize both Arnie and Maggie Gunderson. They have been guests on the Project Censored Show numerous times because we have covered concerns about nuclear power in the environment and particularly what's been going on for years now in Fukushima, Japan. Maggie Gunderson founded Fairwinds Energy Education back in 2008, whose mission has remained to educate the public about nuclear power production, engineering, reliability, and safety issues. Arnie Gunderson has more than 45 years of nuclear power engineering experience, and he has a master's degree in nuclear engineering, holds a nuclear safety patent, and was a licensed reactor operator. He's also a former nuclear industry senior vice president and has managed and coordinated projects at 70 nuclear power plants in the U.S. So, Arnie and Maggie, welcome back to the Project Censored Show.
It's good to be back.
Thank you, Mickey. Thank you so much for having us. We really appreciate this opportunity.
Let's start with you, Arnie, because you were in Japan, and I want to remind listeners, because the corporate media has forgotten all about nuclear disaster in Fukushima, Japan, after the tsunami there back in 2011. Arnie Gunderson, could you give us a little update, and then we want to talk more about what you're all doing at Fairwinds?
You're right. The world has forgotten about Japan. In fact, the Japanese are trying desperately to make sure the world does forget. You know, they want the world's attention on the 2020 Olympics, and don't worry about the man behind the curtain there with Fukushima. But this was my fourth trip. I went in September and taught Japanese citizen scientists how to take radiation samples. We wound up with 140 samples and shipped them back to a lab here in the United States. But we're developing a core of people over there who can send us samples without us being there. A couple of the real quick highlights. The wild boar population is booming in Fukushima, and that's because back before the disaster, they would kill them and eat them. But now they're so radioactive, they can't be eaten. So the wild boar in Fukushima now are like deer in the United States. You know, you drive down the highway, and I was there for 2 weeks, and I saw three of them. They're so radioactive that the Japanese have a special incinerator that they have to incinerate the wild boar in.
This is a signifier of what, then?
It's a signifier that the ground contamination, you know, they eat what's on the ground, is highly radioactive even now. We've been saying that for years, and that's that the prefecture is being recontaminated. The Japanese went through and they cleaned the towns that people live in, and 10 to 20 feet on either side of the roads. In that cleanup, they generated 30 million tons of radioactive waste. But that's only 5% of the prefecture. 95% of it they never cleaned up. And so now when the wind blows or the storm comes, all that contamination blows right back into these towns where the people are living. That's what we saw. We saw the wild boar are so contaminated. That's an indication that the cleanup has been ineffective.
That's an amazing update. Maggie Gunderson, let's bring you into the conversation here. Remind our listeners what you do at Fairwinds Energy Education, and maybe this will help contextualize further some of the things that Arnie Gunderson was just saying.
When we first began, we were doing more of a journalistic experience where we were telling people what was happening all the time at the meltdowns at Fukushima Daiichi, and then we've gone on to talk about all different sites. But during the last 2.5 years, we've emphasized more science. We are working with other engineering colleagues and other doctors who have their PhDs in energy economy or in radiation dust, radioactive dust, for example, and we work with them to produce scientific data. Arnie and Dr. Marco Kaltofen of Worcester Polytechnic Institute had a peer-reviewed article in Staten, The Science of the Total Environment. And that's regarding the migrating radioactive dust and ongoing spread of radioactivity in Japan and other locations that they've tested and sampled.
Tell us more about this sampling.
What's exciting is the fact that we're crowdsourcing our funding, that three of the four trips to Japan were crowdsourced. So thank you very much to people of Japan and the Americans that contributed. And we're also now crowdsourcing the collection of radioactive material. Not just in Japan, we're collecting radioactive material in the UK, near the Sellafield nuclear reactor, and in Chernobyl. And right here in the United States, you know, in California, you guys had one of the very first meltdowns at Santa Susana. And we're still collecting vacuum cleaner bags from people's homes in the Santa Susana area. So we're crowdsourcing not only the funding to send me to teach citizens, but then we now have a core of citizens around the world who can send us good data. And that's really exciting.
Many of these citizen scientists are scientists in other disciplines or science teachers, and they really want to pursue finding out the truth. And it's just amazing, the response.
So you all are again crowdsourcing and using citizen science as a way to get information. And is this because regulatory agencies, governments are failing to even address these issues or ignore them altogether?
It's two-sided. One is the regulatory issues, and I'll let Arnie talk about that one a little bit. But the other one is that this type of data that we're analyzing is not something you can do with a regular radiation detector. It's not airborne radiation in the terms of just monitored radioactive isotopes. It's dust, and that dust can blow in the wind, can be carried in the rain or the snow or in any washing down of rain or snow melt, and it's inhaled. And then it bioaccumulates in the land and comes up in food sources or is eaten by wild boar, cattle, whatever. And all those food sources are getting contaminated, and then it'll cause GI cancers and lung cancers in the animals exposed and in the people exposed.
And getting back to that government issues, our government, the UK government, the Japanese government, all went out of their way to downplay Fukushima and continue to do that. One of the great things about the paper that Dr. Kaltofen and I wrote is that it shows that the International Atomic Energy Agency's model for determining what the people of Japan are receiving in a dose is wrong. It's too low. The Japanese are underestimating what their population is receiving. Mm-hmm. But there's a lot of money on the other side of this argument. I was at the Japanese Atomic Energy Agency's lab in Fukushima, and they've got a $4 million lab. It's beautiful. And we asked them, well, where's your data? And they said, well, we have data. Matter of fact, they have pretty similar data to what Dr. Kaltofen and I have determined. They said, we're just not releasing it. So they know what we know. They just don't want the world to know. So that seems to be our role right now as the person that's telling the world what corporations are not willing to tell them.
We're speaking with Maggie and Arnie Gunderson of Fair Winds Energy Education. That's fairwinds.org, F-A-I-R-E-W-I-N-D-S. You can go to the website to learn more. I'm Mickey Huff. This is the Project Censored Show. And, of course, Project Censored has long covered not only the Fukushima catastrophe, but also issues with nuclear power and certainly issues within government and even regulatory agencies. And you just heard Arnie Gunderson talking about how it isn't necessarily such that these governments and agencies are unaware of problems that exist. It's that they are not sharing that information with the public, and apparently many in the corporate media aren't bothering to ask those questions. But we here at Project Censored are asking those questions, and we're very fortunate to know Arnie and Maggie Gunderson and the Fairwinds Education, energy education people, because they're on the ground. And they're dealing with citizen scientists, and they're coordinating information to get it to the public. So, Arnie and Maggie Gunderson, can you talk to us a little bit more about who some of the citizen scientists are, or what do you mean by that term?
We've had people contact us wanting to help get information. And so we train them on how to do the sampling. And there are many people participating. There are a number of young mothers who want to protect their children. There are retired physicists, retired nuclear engineers who are really disturbed by what's happened in their country. There are medical doctors who were stopped from diagnosing patients with radiation.
On the team that I had in Fukushima, there was an interesting blend. We had two hibakusha, which are the survivors of the A-bomb. One was a Nagasaki survivor, and another was a Hiroshima survivor. Another person had been, as a young boy, was firebombed in Tokyo. So we had this old guard who just did not want to see nuclear get a foothold in Japan again. But then we had Toyota engineers who had worked for 10 years here in the States, and moms and dads, and lay people as well. So it was a wonderful blend. We've also had medical doctors, and the medical doctors have been prohibited from making diagnoses of radiation sickness. In fact, the Japanese require that they diagnose people whose hair is falling out, noses are bleeding, and skin is all blotchy. They have to say that's stress if they want to get paid. So it's a blend of people who just care passionately about the planet.
So again, this is again what you're mentioning when you say citizen scientists, and you're being able to crowdfund, crowdsource, and get raise funds to be able to help do this, and you're being contacted by so many people around the world. You know, Arne Gundersen, we should definitely be looking at how things are in Japan, Fukushima, and the region. But because we do live in the United States, and that's a concern for us that live here, whether we're in California on the West Coast or in the East Coast, can you tell us a little bit about some things that we should be paying attention to here?
Let me tell you about two things, and then Maggie has a global warming issue as well. You know, California had a near miss just recently, and it was not publicized at all. You had that large dam that was in danger of collapsing.
Oroville, yes.
But if it had collapsed, it would have flooded downtown Sacramento. Well, there was a nuclear power plant in Sacramento years ago called Rancho Seco. The plant is gone, but the nuclear fuel is still there. And if that dam failed, that nuclear fuel would have been flooded with muddy water and not been able to cool. On the East Coast, we had Sandy just about 60 miles south of New York City a couple of years ago. And houses were floating down the street, blocking the evacuation paths. 39 emergency sirens out of 45 didn't work. And the emergency cooling pumps were within 6 inches of being flooded out.
That's Arne Gundersen at Fairwinds Energy Education. We're speaking with Arne Gundersen and Maggie Gundersen. We're talking about the radioactive fallout and issues regarding nuclear power, certainly what has happened in Fukushima years ago, and also things to worry about in the United States. I'm Mickey Huff. This is the Project Censored Show. We're going to take a brief musical break, but when we come back, we're going to hear from Maggie Gundersen, and we're going to shift some of the focus to global warming. Please stay with us. Welcome back to the Project Censored Show. I am your host, Mickey Huff. Our guests today are Arne and Maggie Gundersen. They are on the board of directors of Fairwinds Energy Education. We're talking about nuclear energy and environmental hazards, contamination, and some dangers here, of course, associated with it over the years, stemming back not just to Fukushima, but prior. And before the break, you heard Arne Gundersen talking about, you know, sort of leading our conversation into climate change and global warming. And Maggie Gundersen, you wanted to say something about that.
Well, there's several major issues of concern here in the U.S. First off, the Mark I nuclear reactors, boiling water reactors, that are still operating, that are the same model as Fukushima have not had the required modifications and haven't taken into consideration the climate change impact or the results of those meltdowns. Along with that is the hurricane issue and the climate change issues confronting all of the ocean bordering plants. As the seawater rises, and it is rising, then the pumps get wiped out, and that's what happened at Fukushima Daiichi. And during this last Hurricane Irma, they kept plants running in Florida. It's really hard when the plant is kept running because the fuel is very, very hot, and that means it's harder to cool down. If the pumps are wiped out, then there's going to be a meltdown. And Florida Power and Light did not take the appropriate action. They didn't shut their plants down in the midst of a major hurricane.
In Florida, Turkey Point has two operating nukes and two new nukes that are proposed and not yet under construction. Well, the storm surge for the new nukes, because of global climate change, is going to be 10 feet higher than the storm surge for the old nukes that are already operating. Now, you would think then that the solution would be to shut down the old nukes because they obviously can't withstand a 21st century storm surge. But the Nuclear Regulatory Commission said no. They said they have their license and they're good to go for 60 years.
And, you know, Hurricane Harvey, the hurricane that hit Houston, caused all kinds of problems in the petroleum refinement industries. And there's just a toxic stew and soup there. Again, not to compare or contrast levels of disaster, but, I mean, it just seems like the lack of planning, this is literally setting us up for catastrophe, and not just local, but on a global scale.
You know, Harvey, there was a nuclear plant right near there called the South Texas Project, and management kept it running right all the way through it in some sort of a macho-induced adrenaline rush. But can you imagine if there had been a flood of the cooling pumps, which has already happened on several occasions, how could you have evacuated Houston when it was flooded? Our emergency planning assumes a beautiful day where people can get on their cars and drive away very peacefully. But in the middle of mayhem, which is much more likely that a disaster would occur, there's no way an evacuation plan can be effective. So, yeah, it's an awful situation. Global warming makes nuclear power even more dangerous.
Maggie Gunderson, let's go back to you, and we kind of, you know, we begin to wind down the segment. I just wanted to give you an opportunity to talk more about Fairwinds Energy Education, either you or Arnie, your website, so much information on it about demystifying nuclear power, on meltdowns, certainly ways that our listeners could support your work. Talk to us a little bit more about why you're doing these things and what's going on.
Both Arnie and I came from the nuclear industry, and we believed in the Atoms for Peace program, which was supposed to stop nuclear proliferation. But as we belatedly learned in our careers, it's all one cycle. It's one fuel cycle, or we call it a fuel chain because it can be broken, and that the nuclear power industry is intertwined with the weapons industry. And we need to shut that down, whether it's the weapons or the production of nuclear weapons or whether it's nuclear power. No human being should be able to push these buttons or create something that can't be cleaned up, like you said, has a toxic stew. You can't see, smell, or taste radiation unless there's a major, major catastrophe. And then there's a metallic taste, but you still can't see the radiation moving towards you. So people don't know when they're getting major doses of radiation, and that's happening in locations all around this country and overseas, in UK, in Japan, and in other countries where they're having releases and they tell people nothing's happened.
So that's really what Fairwinds is all about. You know, we try to keep citizens, and most of our work is always in English, but some of it's translated into German as well as Japanese. We try to teach citizens about the hazards of the atom. And if you go up on the site, there's over 200 videos, probably 100 podcasts, and numerous, numerous articles and pieces of work that we've done. And it's pretty searchable, too. So I'd advise people to check out fairwinds.org. There's an E in the middle of that. And while you're there, please hit the donate button. This crowdsourcing does require us to do work, and plane fare to Japan is $2,000. So we try to keep our costs down, but there still are costs.
Well, Arnie and Maggie Gunderson, I thank you for your work and for always coming on and sharing your work on the Project Censored Show. I know that we already have some plans to talk again in the near future to talk about some other information you have and some other reports and studies that you're doing in addition to what you're finding with soil contamination and other things. Also, that you're featured as protagonist in a new film called Power Struggle, a documentary film about democracy in action in Vermont. So thank you again for coming on the program. Special thanks to Robert Manning, John Bertucci, promotion of the program and connections. And thank you both for the important work you do.
Thank you, Mickey.
Thank you, Mickey, for having us on, and thank you for all you do for freedom in this country.
This is the Project Censored Show. I'm Mickey Huff. Coming up, we'll hear from Poets Reading the News. Please stay with us.
Come on, children. Come on, children. Come on, children. Come on, children.
Welcome back to the Project Censored Show. I'm your host, Mickey Huff. Our listeners may remember a couple weeks ago, we had Elle Aviv Newton on of Poets Reading the News. She is the co-editor of PoetsReadingTheNews.com. And Jenna Spagnolo is also here today, the co-editor of PoetsReadingTheNews.com. And they're joining us here in studio again today. And we'd like you to remind our listeners, what exactly is Poets Reading the News? And why are we having Poets Reading the News? So, Jenna, tell us.
Thanks, Mickey. Thanks for having us on. So, Poets Reading the News is the world's only newspaper written entirely by poets. What we're doing is we're reinventing the way that journalism can be read by putting first and foremost poetry and art. So, today, given the fact that you guys have been talking a lot about environmental issues and Fukushima, Elle and I brought a couple of poems that deal with the end of the world.
That's right. That's what we're here to talk about.
It sometimes feels that way every day. There's a new reason, a new thing, a new something that happens that makes us really question where we're heading, not just in the United States, but globally in terms of being a species, yeah. It seems. And, you know, the topics earlier on nuclear energy, contamination, and so on. And, Elle, when you were on the show a couple weeks ago, we talked sort of about the cathartic kind of release and different ways of sort of processing things that we can hear through poetry and arts, you know, melding of poetry and journalism. And again, we're very intrigued by the good work you're doing. And you're over a year old now, right?
Yeah.
And so you're getting more people are getting interested, and you have more people sending in submissions.
That's right. Yeah. We have a very dynamic and supportive group of writers and readers who have been supporting us. And, you know, we're really committed to highlighting marginalized voices, highlighting poems from all around the world, and we welcome even the amateur poet to send work into us.
And how can people do that, just since this is the way of maybe getting that word out even more?
Sure. Just visit our website. It's www.poetsreadingthenews.com. We have a helpful submissions page, And as Jenna mentioned, we're open to absolutely everyone. As I spoke about, we have lots of journalists returning to poetry now. We accept work from people who haven't really written it before. And then we also have like incredibly established writers come as well. So it's really a range of people.
It's definitely a fantastic project. It's a brilliant idea. And poetsreadingthenews.com is where you can learn more. So Elle and Jenna, you're going to read to us a few germane poets about from today's topic.
Indeed we are. We're going to dive into the archives a little bit, not too far, to find some works that deal with North Korea and the arms race that's happening in the world.
Okay.
So the first poem, actually, how about Jenna, how about you read the first poem?
Sure. So this is called Warhead. It's by Alejandro Escude. He's a poet writing out of Los Angeles. The missile is a powerful poem, black against the sky, arcing over the earth, conquering nature, beholden to none. DPRK generals leaping in the photo. What glee? Are they feeling the jubilation of the self-made soul? We watch the footage of the large projectile, a casing, make its way along cluster upon cluster of red flags. What language does nature speak? Whatever the case, the Pacific has never been so small, especially in California, where the waves are preternatural, neon-laden, dumb as the clock inside a warhead the size of Hannibal's elephant.
The imagery there certainly makes us think of some of the things that we're talking about just earlier when we had Arnie and Maggie Gunderson on, who were talking about Fukushima and the unfolding disaster that's still going on there. And also, of course, that even though these things seem so far away, globally we're all connected with our ecosystems. So very, very poignant materials. Elle, you have something to share with us today.
I do. I have a poem straight from the end of the world. And it's called Oh, Let It Be an Arms Race by M.F. Simone Roberts, who is based in D.C. And it begins with a quote by someone she titles simply 45. We will outmatch them at every pass and outlast them all. Let the sky glow dark and prowl with fury, liquefy or open its mouth to scream, and the air run off to safer planets. Oh, let arms race to lift each other just slightly up now. Support the back to open the chest, up to chase the air chasing itself out of the sky. Laced arms and arched trunks, we could be our own defiant fence, a shelter for someone softer, a watershed of arms encircling anyone left thirsty on the wrong end of the old world, its fear, its metal and trembling law. Let us be a race to gaze longest into each other's eyes. Regard the dust of long-dead suns, blasted and never-known planets, swirling and waving in the tides of our blood anyway. A bit of the great ocean spilling, maybe, over a lid and onto a cheek. So difficult is it for mortals to look to the back of time and say yes. Oh, let us race to translate adoration with our arms until we cry the widest yes to every future we must live into now. Even that one where, you know the one, a tiny star returns us to being stars. Let us live into whatever may come singing. If we must race to a flashing end, let the boiling air slam our ghosts onto the shattering walls behind us, like graffiti sprayed by the angel of history, all the world churning to rubble in her wings sky-wide wake, of billions of crime-scene outlines, of our last being, arms braced, holding each other up, ready, and forward, even into this, yes. And the future race, yes, of more intelligent, yes, and gentle creatures, yes. We'll see our ghosted shadows, yes, and tell stories about never giving in and never, yes, oh yes, letting fall. Ooh,
yeah,
let me tell you.
Certainly a couple of stanzas there that stick out. Certainly the ghostly talk and imagery as well as the billions of crime scene outlines. These are very heavy topics, but this gives us almost such a more visual, although obviously literary, but visual way. What are your thoughts, Elle?
I thought when I first read this poem, thank God she wrote this poem, because I have always thought of the threat of nuclear war as this total abstraction that couldn't be faced. And then I read this work, and this poet does an incredible job of yes, as you say, like provoking these images and what it would really mean, like really going far enough to explore what would it mean if like literally an entire country or the world were to meet such a devastating end as that. Would there ever be someone to think about the implications of what we did? What would it look like? And also just to explore, you know, how absurd this notion is that we've come here as a species.
Jenna, anything you'd like to add to that?
Yeah, I think in a way this poem is reflective on the fact that some things are out of our hands, right? We can do a lot as activists and as private citizens to work for a better world. But at a certain point, there are actors who are not acting in our best interest and who might be incredibly incompetent.
That's why it begins with that quote by Trump,
45,
right?
Yeah.
So this poem is helpful to me to figure out how to let go of some of that anxiety.
It's true. It's a poem of surrendering to circumstance in some way.
Indeed. An important thing, too, that the arts and poetry allow us to do, it sometimes journalism, you know, really ramps us up and leaves us on edge and doesn't leave us with enough solutions or paths or even more, just sometimes we can't necessarily find the immediate solution or to a particular problem, but certainly maybe helps us deal with or comprehend these things in a bigger way.
Yeah, it definitely does.
Jenna Spagnuolo, Ella Viv Newton, thanks so much for joining the Project Censored Show. PoetsReadingTheNews.com is where to go. And stay tuned to future Project Censored shows as we hope to have more poets reading the news.
Thank you so much.
Thank you, Mickey. Appreciate it.
I'd like to make a special announcement for those people in the San Francisco Bay Area. This weekend is the 4th annual Howard Zinn Book Fair. That's Sunday, November 19th at Mission Campus of City College of San Francisco, 1125 Valencia Street. You can find a full program online at howardzinnbookfair.com, a celebration of people's history, past, present, and future. This year's theme, The World We Want. Also, Friday night, there is a special trivia night. It is the People's History Trivia Night, a night for social justice teachers and friends. That's Friday, November 17th, 6 to 9 p.m. at the Women's Building. That's the San Francisco Women's Building. You can learn more at zinnedproject.org. And we're especially happy to make these kinds of announcements because Howard Zinn was, of course, not only a significant people's historian, he was also a Project Censored judge. So check out howardzinnbookfair.com.
Supporting human conditions, not free market propaganda and corrupt politicians, cause they're owned by special interest groups that fund their campaign. That's why you hear the same old things they claim, but change never came. It's a dirty game maintained by rain for capital gain.
You've been listening to the Project Censored Show. I'm your host, Mickey Huff, executive producer along with Peter Phillips. Our senior producer is Anthony Fest, and Erica Bridgman is our engineer. The Project Censored Show airs on some 40 stations across the U.S. from Maui to New York. To learn more about how to bring the Project Censored Show to your community, you can contact me at mickey@projectcensored.org or through our website. Please follow and like us on Facebook and Twitter. We'll see you next time. Up next, Terra Verde.
Listening to Radio Free Radical. Coming up next,
TUC Radio.
TUC Radio, Time of Useful Consciousness. Dr. Helen Caldicott, North Korea, Donald Trump, and the Threat of Nuclear War. Helen Caldicott is an Australian physician, author, and anti-nuclear campaigner. She gave up her work as medical doctor to deal with an emergency much vaster than her specific field as pediatrician required of her, that of the nuclear danger that threatens all life on this planet. In over 40 years of activism, she addressed nuclear power and nuclear weapons, nuclear testing and radiation, from uranium weapons and mining to nuclear waste. She engaged with a major nuclear power accidents from Three Mile Island, Chernobyl to Fukushima. And she did all this through organizations she founded, talks she gave, books she wrote, and conferences that she organized. And she never really stopped. The International Physicians for the Prevention of Nuclear War invited Helen Caldicott to speak at their September 2017 conference in Basel, Switzerland. At that conference, she expressed her grave concern about Donald Trump's extraordinary messages against North Korea, threatening fire and fury and total annihilation. And she's not alone with her concerns. As I'm recording this introduction in mid-November 2017, the Senate Foreign Relations Committee is holding a hearing on President Trump's unlimited authority to deploy nuclear weapons. It's the first time the Senate has examined the nuclear launch protocol in more than 40 years. In August of this year, listeners to NPR asked, if Donald Trump can just launch nuclear weapons via the nuclear code that he has access to at all times. Senior news analyst Cokie Roberts gave a comprehensive answer.
The heated rhetoric over the past week has many wondering about the use of nuclear weapons. The only time they've ever been used was by the United States during World War II. The rules for how nuclear weapons are used today have not changed since President Truman's time. So just who is in charge of launching a nuclear attack? That's a question many of you wanted answered this week, and we are putting it to Cokie Roberts in our regular Ask Cokie segment. So here's our first question.
This is Anne Moore from Cypress, Texas, and I wanted to know, if Congress has neither declared war nor authorized military action, would an executive order be sufficient to launch nuclear weapons?
Actually, nothing as formal as an executive order is required. It's simply the president saying that he wants to launch a nuclear attack. Presumably, he says that in a very short period of time after the military has detected a missile launch by a hostile nation. And the president's authority derives from the Atomic Energy Act of 1946, which was passed amid much controversy the year after the bombs were dropped.
Wait, what kind of controversy?
Well, you know, laws are passed in the context of the times. Yeah. And the scientists who had worked on the bombs were having enormous qualms about what they had unleashed. And they started lobbying Congress to make sure that the bombs stayed under civilian control. Right. And there was a sense then that the generals were trigger happy and that they shouldn't have the last word on these massively lethal weapons. So the president has the sole authority over nuclear weapons.
Well, that gets us to our next question. Let's give a listen.
My name is Teresa Eamon, and I'm from Monroe, North Carolina. Does the president have access to the nuclear codes that he could launch a weapon without additional approval? What safety mechanisms are in place?
Well, the codes are in what's called the nuclear football. That's the thing that travels with the president everywhere he goes.
It's not shaped like a football, right?
No, it's not. But say the president learned of an attack, the person carrying the football, who's vetted, by the way, by the FBI, the Secret Service, and the Department of Defense, would show the president his options, whether he should attack by sea, air, whatever. And then the president has a device, which is called the biscuit, like a credit card, and it shows that he's the actual president. And then he gives the order to use the weapons, and he can launch close to 1,000 warheads in minutes.
Wow.
After that, there is no veto power. Under the law, the military must carry out the president's order.
Wait, but what happens if, say, a president is in no condition to make that kind of decision. Let's say he's drunk or otherwise impaired.
Well, that's a question that's been asked for decades, and actually some members of Congress are asking it again. Theoretically, the Secretary of Defense could refuse to pass the order down the line of command, but that would be illegal, maybe even treasonous.
Wow.
There have been reports in the years since Richard Nixon's death that his secretaries of defense and state, James Schlesinger and Henry Kissinger, were worried about the president's drinking and his general state of mind, and that they conspired to make sure that no one carried out the president's orders about nuclear weapons without checking in with one of them. If that's true, it was illegal.
That's incredible.
Yeah.
That was an explanation of the power Donald Trump has to launch a nuclear attack. This interview with Cokie Roberts was aired by NPR on August 8, 2017. Next up is Dr. Helen Caldicott's talk in Basel, Switzerland, at the Conference of the International Physicians for the Prevention of Nuclear War.
Thank you very much for inviting me, Andreas, and our PPNW. Physicians, doctors are very important because we try and save lives. We're not always successful. But the greatest threat to human health today is the risk of nuclear war. Now, a lot of people don't understand that, especially young people. I helped to lead the movement in the 1980s against nuclear war in America. So here we are in Switzerland, and no one knows what's going on, I don't think. Hands up those who think there could be a nuclear war tomorrow. Yeah, only those who are informed. We are closer to nuclear war than we were at the height of the Cold War in the 1980s, when Russia and America were like this. I went to see Ronald Reagan in the White House because he thought nuclear war would be a good idea. And he was excerpting a book called With Enough Shovels, and there was a man in the Federal Emergency Management Agency called T.K. Jones, and he said, if there are enough shovels to go around, we're all going to make it. That means when the bombs are coming from Russia to America, you have half an hour to get out your shovel, dig a hole 6 feet long, 2 feet wide, deep, and get in the hole, and then you put two doors on top and dirt on the top. And T.K. Jones said it's the dirt that does it. In other words, you dig your own grave, but of course you don't have enough time, and it was all stupid. I met Ronald Reagan's daughter, Patty Davis. A tall girl came up to talk to me with long black hair, and she said, I'm Patty Davis. And she said, you're the only person, I think, on Earth who could change his mind about nuclear weapons. Will you see him? And I said, yeah, I'll see him, but I don't want his advisors there. I want to see him alone. So she rang me up the next day. She said, we've got time at the end of his working day, an hour. And I said, what time is that? She said, 4 o'clock. So he knocked off at 4 o'clock, the President of the United States. So we met each other, and Patty and I in the Secret Service car swept into the White House, and we walked into the downstairs library in which there were no books. We waited for a while, and in walked Ronnie, and he was a bit nervous. He didn't know what to do. So I took his hand and I said, how do you do, Mr. President? Then he didn't know where to sit. So I said, you sit there and I'll sit there. And I said, you probably don't know who I am. And he said, yes. You're an Australian, you read On the Beach, which you young people must read, and you're scared of nuclear war. And I said, yes, that's right. And he said, well, I too am scared of nuclear war, but I believe in building more bombs. So we're off to a flying start. I spent an hour and a quarter with him, and every single thing he said to me was wrong. I'd just written a book called Missile Envy, and I was full of facts and figures, and so when he'd make a statement, I'd stop him and correct him. And he got very anxious, and his cheeks flushed. So I ended up half the time holding his hand, like a doctor holding the hand of a patient, to reassure him and make him relax. I estimated his IQ to be about 100, which is average when you take in Down syndromes and mentally retarded people. Very average. He would have been a good chicken farmer. but not President of the United States. And we've got a similar person now who's actually worse, who knows nothing. And when I left, I thought that I hadn't convinced him. But, you know, soon after he started to say nuclear war must never be fought and can never be won, and he started working with Gorbachev, a wonderful man who brought an end to the Cold War. And Ronnie Reagan and Gorbachev almost agreed in Reykjavik years ago in a meeting that they would abolish nuclear weapons, abolish them. But they got stuck on Star Wars. And Reagan thought Star Wars was meaning the whole of America was covered with a big yellow plastic shield and the Russian missiles would come in and go boink, boink, boink and not ever hit America. And he was totally wrong. But he was obstinate, and so was Gorbachev, and they got stuck on that, and so he lost the opportunity to abolish nuclear weapons. Now, let me tell you about today. We thought when the Cold War ended and the Berlin Wall came down, thank God, we were so tired. I'd go to 3 cities a day, get in a plane, give a speech, get in another plane, give a speech. I was so tired. And we mobilized 80% of Americans to be afraid of nuclear war, 80%. That wasn't bad in 5 years. How did we do it? By educating people and making them scared. Like when you tell a patient they've got a cancer, you have to help them with their pain and their grief. And we did that with the Americans, and they mobilized. And so did the Germans. I knew Petra Kelly, who founded the Green Party in Germany, and she led the movement here. So when the Berlin Wall came down, we thought, well, that's good, they'll get rid of weapons. Well, of course, if you know the military and the military-industrial complex, Lockheed Martin, Northrop Grumman, Raytheon, and all these wicked, wicked killing firms, they don't give up, and they're mostly men. And I'm fed up with men. Because we're about to probably destroy the only life in the universe. And when you look at parliaments, there are rows of men. Where are the women? When you come to Europe, there's a man on a horse in every square in Europe who's a killer. Napoleon was a killer. He's got a great grave in Paris. Why do we glorify war? Why do we glorify killers? What's it all about? Where are the women? 52% of us are women. We have the babies. We have our nurturing instincts. And yet we let the men, and I'm really angry, because I think there will be a nuclear war. And I said to my family, when I left, I'll be home if there's not a nuclear war. Let me tell you this current situation. We've got a man in the White House who has, I think, never read a book. He tweets, that's how he runs his presidency. And the man who invented tweeting, he said that it leads to a very short attention span, and that's what this president has, a short attention span. He knows nothing. He doesn't understand geography, history, or anything else. And he just likes big crowds and adulation. Now, there are still 16,400 nuclear weapons in the world, and of those, Russia and America own 94%. The only countries that can destroy life on Earth are Russia and America. So who are the real terrorists? They're Russia and America, and they're evil. And I'm sick of it. And they say, oh, the terrorists, look, there's this man coming in from Iraq to, you know, drive a bus into people or shoot people. Well, maybe he saw his family being blown up into pieces by American drones and bombs, and no wonder he's angry and goes to London and kills people. Or goes to America and kills people. We're producing terrorists. We're talking about the creation. There are 3 trillion galaxies. Can you imagine that? And you look up in space and you look at these trees and the animals. How did this happen on this little tiny lump of rock? So we've got 16,400 nuclear weapons, and Russia and America own 94% of them. North Korea, they've got a couple of bombs. Yeah, they could blow up Seoul or New York. I don't really care about that. Yeah, they'd kill millions of people. But I care about the creation, about snails. I once did a project on snails when I was at school, or my sunflowers, or my roses. Do we ever think about that? So let me tell you how a nuclear war could start. There's a man who walks after the president, an officer, with a big case, and it's called the football. In the case are the codes to start a nuclear war. And apparently, officially, the only person in America who can start a nuclear war is the president. And the president is a narcissist. He's got a short attention span. He's got a bad temper. He's volatile, and you never know what he's going to do next. I don't think he does either. Absolutely mad. But America doesn't want to talk about madness or that sort of thing. I mean, you have American exceptionalism. Aren't they the most powerful, most important country in the world? They're the most dangerous country in the world. There are over 1,000 missile silos in North Dakota and Colorado and other states. In the missile is a bomb, which is a huge hydrogen bomb. There are planes armed with hydrogen bombs ready to take off any minute in America, all the time. In America and Europe and China and England and Australia and Canada and the like, every city is targeted with at least one hydrogen bomb. Every town with a population of 50,000 or more is targeted. Think of Switzerland, you're targeted. All industrial facilities, all universities are targeted, all military facilities. There are so many bombs, such a redundancy of weapons. I think New York's got about 10 hydrogen bombs targeted on it alone. The weapon will land in 20 minutes or 30 minutes after being launched. It's how long the missiles take. They go up into space, they transit through space, the bomb continues. The bus drops off, which is the missile, and the bomb continues and lands accurately on target, right on this theatre. It will dig a hole 3/4 of a mile. This is a 20 megaton bomb, 20 million tons of TNT. Dig a hole 3/4 of a mile wide and 800 feet deep. That's nearly the whole university, converting us and all the buildings to radioactive fallout shot up in the mushroom cloud. 6 miles in all direction, everyone is vaporised. There was a little boy in Hiroshima reaching out to catch a red dragonfly in his hand against the blue sky, and there was a blinding flash, and he disappeared, turned into gas, and left his shadow on the pavement, which is now in the Hiroshima Museum. There was a woman running, holding her baby, and she and the baby had been turned into a charcoal statue. People vaporized or charcoalized 6 miles out. And then out to 20 miles, huge fires, everyone burnt, lethally injured, winds of 500 miles an hour, suck people out of buildings, turning them into missiles travelling at 100 miles an hour, windows popcorn and shards of glass travelling at 100 miles an hour, decapitate people. The whole area totally destroyed. And then a firestorm will emerge of 3,000 square miles and burn everything, in the middle of winter even. Everything will burn. And a huge amount of smoke will rise up into the stratosphere. And if all the bombs are used between Russia and America, the Earth will be covered with a cloud so thick in the stratosphere it will block out the sun for 10 years, causing a short ice age and the end of almost all life on Earth. And it could happen tonight by accident, by hacking into the computer, by computers making mistakes, by a 16-year-old thinking it might be quite fun, actually, to blow up the Earth. Every day there are over 1,000 hackers in the Pentagon, every day. It hasn't happened yet, but it easily could. Or Trump could decide, in his wisdom, so-called, to have a nuclear war and blow up the world. I'm not exaggerating. I said to my kids when I left, I'll be back if there isn't a nuclear war. I think it's closer now than it's ever been. And did you know those facts I just said? It's really scary. Okay, now, quickly, I have to talk about the hot spots in the world. We've got North Korea. Now, at the end of the Korean War between North and South Korea, Americans never signed a peace treaty with North Korea, just an armistice treaty. The North Koreans want to talk to America, and they want America to sign a peace treaty. They want a non-aggression pact, and they want a trade. And in fact, Jimmy Carter set up a situation like that, but George Bush abolished it. And they are ready to talk. They were one of the countries with nuclear weapons that agreed at the United Nations to abolish nuclear weapons. And there's a huge movement at the UN. 122 countries have signed on to abolish nuclear weapons, but America hasn't. And she never will, because she's so arrogant. And if America doesn't, Russia won't. And therefore, I don't know what good it's going to do. But I don't know what good the United Nations treaty signed by many countries in the world. If America doesn't change, we're doomed. And you've got to understand the power of these corporations that run the Pentagon. And every year, twice a year, America conducts war games south of the 38th parallel, just south of the border of North Korea. And they have decapitation games where they're going to take out Pyongyang. North Korea saw what happened to Gaddafi. Gaddafi was killed, and before they killed him, they shoved a gun right up his anus. And that was orchestrated by Hillary Clinton. Obscene. And now Libya is a failed state run by tribes. They saw what happened to Hussein. Hussein worked for the CIA since he was 21 in Iraq. Wicked. Thou shalt not kill. You don't turn people into body parts with drones, with their flesh hanging on the walls. That's what we're doing every day in Yemen, Libya, Syria, Afghanistan, Iraq. And it's great because the weapons makers, bombs cost millions of dollars each. And when you drop a bomb, then you have to make a new one. Killing. I've spent my life trying to save children with cystic fibrosis and leukemia and cancer. And when they die, part of you dies. Life is so precious. How dare we go to other countries and kill people? Now, what else happened? When America agreed with Gorbachev to take the wall down, America promised that they would not enlarge NATO. And the little countries that were formerly in the Soviet Union, Lithuania, Latvia, Estonia, and all the rest, they would remain independent. But Norman Augustine from Lockheed Martin was bad for Lockheed Martin, because when the Cold War stopped, you didn't have to make weapons anymore. And they'd lose their profits and stop stealing $1 trillion from the American people every year to make weapons to kill. America has no free healthcare system, no free education system. It's got a killing system, and that's where their tax dollars go. So Norman Augustine went to these little countries and said, do you want to become a democracy? Join NATO. But then they had to invest in weapons. So the little countries were ignorant and persuaded to join NATO. So they've moved NATO, which is America. NATO is America, right up to the border of Russia. How provocative is that? How dare they? Imagine if Russia and the Warsaw Pact moved into Canada, right up to the border of America. America would blow up the world, without a doubt. She nearly did during the Cuban Missile Crisis. I knew McNamara, the Secretary of Defense, who was in the Oval Office with Jack Kennedy. He said, you don't know how close we came to 3 minutes before they blew up the world. 3 minutes or less. I don't know how we're still, I honestly don't know how we're still here, and I'm not exaggerating. So they enlarged NATO, and then the State Department in America, they orchestrated a coup in Ukraine, and they got rid of by a man called Yanukovych, and he fled, and they put in a man called Poroshenko, And that was orchestrated by the State Department and Victoria Nuland, and they spent $15 billion orchestrating that coup. How dare America do that? And now America's worried because, oh, Russia interfered in their election with Hillary Clinton. America's interfered in almost every election over the, since the end of the Second World War, in almost every country, and killed leaders. Like that wonderful man who was a doctor in Chile, Allende. How dare America do things like that? What they did in Central America was wicked in Guatemala and all the other little countries. And they have the gall to say Russia interfered in their election. Let's be frank. You know, I think that Trump has been financed by Russian oligarchs who stole all the Russian oil, etc., and became filthy rich. They've been funding Trump for years. So Trump is, you know, he's dependent upon Russia. You've got to have the guts to stand up. And if America doesn't change, I kid you not, we're doomed. I think I'll stop.
That was Dr. Helen Caldicott on the impending threat of nuclear war. She had been invited to Basel, Switzerland, to address the September 2017 conference of the International Physicians for the Prevention of Nuclear War. Helen Caldicott is an Australian physician, author, and anti-nuclear activist. She led campaigns against nuclear power and nuclear weapons, nuclear testing and radiation, from uranium weapons and mining to nuclear waste. Helen Caldicott also wrote many books, among them If You Love This Planet, Nuclear Madness, What You Can Do, The New Nuclear Danger, Nuclear Power Is Not the Answer, War in Heaven, On the Proliferation of Nuclear Weapons in Space. Her most recent 2017 book is Sleepwalking to Armageddon, an assessment of the political and scientific dimensions of the threat of nuclear war today. Thanks to the International Physicians for the Prevention of Nuclear War for the audio recording of this talk, made on September 14, 2017, in Basel, Switzerland. And thanks to NPR for the excerpt of the commentary by Cokie Roberts on the nuclear launch protocol and the power Donald Trump has to initiate a nuclear war. You can hear this program again for free on TUC Radio's website, tucradio.org. That's tucradio.org. Look under Newest Programs or the Podcast section. There are over 40 free talks and films with Helen Caldicott on TUC Radio's website, spanning the period from Three Mile Island till 2017. My name is Maria Gelarden. Thank you for listening.
Mr. Colin Wallace was employed by a government to tell lies. And indeed, he was a very squalid part of what was a very squalid operation in the north of Ireland at that period of time.
Colin Wallace lived for the British Army. Headhunted in 1968 for the press office in Lisburn, he rose quickly to the rank of Lieutenant Colonel. But the mood in Northern Ireland was changing, and from 1970, in addition to his regular press office duties, Wallace began working with MI5 on so-called psychological operations. In 1974, when assigned to a top-secret project called Clockwork Orange, Colin Wallace had a choice to make.
The basic plan of Clockwork Orange was to feed information to the press to discredit specific individuals and organisations. And although the core of that was certainly about paramilitary groups on both sides, it was clear that a lot of it was highly damaging to key political figures, including the leader of the Labour Party. They believed that the Labour government was under the control or influence of the Soviet Union, and because of their attitude, I suppose, in Ireland, that this was a threat to the security of the realm. And the idea basically was to plant information, and we also had forged documents to substantiate some of this information. We had a false bank account on behalf of a senior Labour minister, and the idea was to create a dossier overall and then give that dossier either in whole or in part to a number of key journalists and then really use them as conduits to get the information to the public. So, bearing in mind that this information was being disseminated during 1974, when there were two general elections in process, the possible implications were enormous. And by mid-1974, I had very mixed emotions. A lot of what I was doing ran totally contrary to what I believed in. I was spending my time engaged in political activity and attempting also to discredit, had I gone ahead with the project, democratically elected politicians, again, totally opposite to what the security forces should have been doing. So I suppose my emotions range from being frightened because I had no one I could really talk to just overall concern about being deflected away from my main role, which was defeating terrorism. And to me, that was a complete waste of my time, energy and resources. And so as the time passed, I think my frustrations and indeed even fears grew. I seemed totally powerless to be able to find a way out of it.
It was disturbing in the extreme. If military intelligence was plotting to undermine Prime Minister Harold Wilson, then the army was effectively in mutiny against its supposed political masters.
I had several meetings with my MI5 contact during the middle and late summer. And at those meetings, I was expressing my growing concern. And eventually it got to the point where I realised that I would have to make a decision. And at that stage, I thought the best way to do was really to call his bluff by saying that I really need written authority. I was trying to say in a matter-of-fact way that in the normal course of events, any activity of this nature needs ministerial clearance. And because of the nature of the information I was handling, that I felt that the time was right for that clearance to be given to me. And then at a follow-up meeting, I said that in the absence of that authority that I couldn't engage in the operation anymore. So it was a very, very strange, uncomfortable session because it's also very unlike me. I don't like to be put in a situation where I'm challenging my own authority because most of the time I believe passionately in what I was doing. This was an occasion where I had to go against all my instincts to really achieve what I felt I had to.
But the Clockwork Orange project wasn't his only concern that summer. For 2 years now, Wallace had been trying, unsuccessfully, to get something done about alleged child sex abuse at a Belfast home for boys.
In 1972, I received a phone call from a social worker, and she said she had some information for the security forces and arranged to meet me. And can remember the woman fairly clearly, slightly plump, round face. I can remember she was wearing glasses with fairly large spectacle frames. She told me that she had been involved in the supervision of one particular boy from West Belfast who claimed to have been sexually abused at the Kinkora boys' home in Belfast. She said that she and her colleagues had raised the matter with the authorities, but nothing had been done. The basic story was that boys in the home were being abused, but also boys from the home were taken out or went out to pre-arranged meetings with individuals in the surrounding area. And the main reason that we were interested was that there were strong links with the loyalist paramilitary community, particularly in East Belfast. I was surprised that, bearing in mind the nature of the allegations, and particularly bearing in mind the fact that we had good working relationships with the RUC, that nothing had been done a year later. And I wrote a fairly strongly worded memo highlighting my concern about the lack of any activity in that respect. I think, too, first of all, I felt very frustrated that nothing had happened. And the fact that children were being abused when they were in the care of the authorities seemed particularly horrific.
In fact, systematic sex abuse at Kinkora would continue unchallenged for another 6 years. Significantly, it would later emerge that the loyalist paramilitary leader who ran the home was also working for MI5. After sending his angry memo, Colin Wallace, who had been promoted just weeks earlier, suddenly found himself a very unpopular man.
After I had written the memo about Kinkora, and after I had decided not to go ahead with Clockwork Orange, I felt life would settle down and I could get back into much more of my traditional form of working. But suddenly, out of the blue, without any warning, David McDyne, the Chief Information Officer at Northern Ireland, told me that I had been requested to go to Minister Defence as a matter of urgency just before Christmas. And in fact, the only time that I could manage to do it comfortably was on Christmas Eve, which was really the beginning of my holiday. So I travelled to Minister Defence main building, and it was a strange and quite hostile interview, which I didn't expect. Very brisk. I was summoned to his office. He said quite bluntly after a pleasantry that they had information that my life was in danger and that I was being moved out of Northern Ireland as a matter of urgency. And I did say to him that I found that strange, bearing in mind that I had just been promoted into a new job. The fact it was hard to see how my life was at risk when I was living in perhaps the most secure garrison in the whole of Northern Ireland. But he just literally wouldn't discuss it at all. He said that was the information he had, and that's what had to happen, and I had to make a choice between one of two locations. So it wasn't a particularly pleasant start to the Christmas holiday. Of course, mulling it over during the holiday period when I had no one to talk to then, all sorts of things came to mind as to what the real reason behind it might be. And I went on holiday feeling very apprehensive, to put it mildly.
After the holiday, Wallace had just a few days to prepare to leave for Preston in the northwest of England. Eileen, his girlfriend and future wife, who also worked in the intelligence services, was transferred to London. On his last day in Northern Ireland, Wallace had one final task to do in his disinformation role. It involved leaking a bogus internal document to the Times journalist Robert Fisk, the sort of thing Wallace had been doing daily for years.
I loaded up my belongings and transported them down to Belfast docks to go on a Royal Navy ship to be transported across to Liverpool. I travelled to the docks, and because of sort of our standard training, I noticed that there was a car following me and did a number of turns down to actually the docks itself and found that this car was still following me. Getting quite concerned at that stage about who was actually in the car, I then called into a military barracks on the way back to Lisburn, and I was surprised to see that the vehicle actually came into the barracks with me. So it was quite clear that they had some official connection. But then as I travelled back to Lisburn, the car followed me again. And I suppose at that stage began to get slightly paranoid about what was going on. And when I got to the outskirts of Lisburn, and I did a few turns around the side streets of Lisburn and came out on the Hillsborough Road and lost them. And so I travelled out to Robert Fisk's house near Hillsborough, went to the door. He wasn't at home, so I put the document I was going to brief him on to the letterbox and left. And when I moved from Northern Ireland, I'd been there literally 24 hours and was having lunch in this beautiful oak-panelled dining room when the chief of staff, a brigadier, said to me, oh, there are two visitors to see you in my office. So I went straight from lunch to the office and found two gentlemen sitting there in smart suits who introduced themselves as detective superintendent in the special branch. And they said that they were investigating the fact that I had, without authority, disclosed a classified document to a journalist. And it was clear during the interview that they knew nothing about what my real job was in Northern Ireland. And when I was asked about the document, I made it clear that I couldn't answer any questions until I had clearance from the Minister of Defence in London. I then contacted the Minister of Defence and asked for guidance on what I should do. I was told at that stage that I could make a statement to the police, but I could not make any reference to my classified job description, nor was I allowed to make any reference to attempts to discredit politicians. And I foolishly went along with it, believing that because the system knew really what I was doing, that they would resolve the matter satisfactorily. So I think when the police officers left, I was in a state of shock. I was thoroughly confused because there was nobody I could speak to. I did try to ring my former boss at Lisburn, and I was told he wasn't available. And it was clear that at that stage, really, no one wanted to know. So I had nobody to talk to. And I suppose when there's a total vacuum and when you have no outlet for that, one gets more and more paranoid about what's going on. So it was a dreadful experience, but I still thought it, somewhere along the line, it's a misunderstanding. I was always imagining the best, that the system was going to do things right. And there was no reason why I should have suspected otherwise. I mean, you know, my promotion and everything else, and although all the indications were there that things were going wrong, I suppose I didn't want to believe that and I didn't want to see that. But I certainly was very, very worried, to put it mildly. It was a nightmare. No, there's no question of that.
Wallace was suspended from his new job pending a disciplinary hearing in London. But under the Official Secrets Act, his MI5 handlers ordered Wallace not to reveal his true job description at the hearing. As a mere press officer, it would be impossible for him to justify having leaked a classified document. If there was one man who could save the day, that was Wallace's former boss at Lisburn, who was called to appear at the hearing. When the day came, however, Wallace was told that he had missed his flight. For months, Wallace had nothing to do but wait in the barracks for the outcome.
In June of 1975, I was in the officers' mess at Preston, and I was told by one of the mess staff that the general, the GOC, wanted to see me. I went to his office and he asked me to sit down. Again, this remarkable, almost baronial hall background, quite surreal. And he said, I have to read this letter to you formally. And he read through the letter exactly as it was. But in effect, formally at that point, I was told that I could resign with effect from the end of that year, or I could be sacked. There was no choice. It was either or. And I was found guilty, therefore, of giving a classified document to a journalist without authority, even though that's what I did for a large part of the time, giving fake classified documents. So I was clear in my own mind that what had happened to me was the result of my refusal to go ahead with Clockwork Orange. I was absolutely convinced, because of the way people in the know responded to me, that I was being set up, or certainly I was being used as a fall guy, that if anything went wrong, I was going to be blamed for what had happened. And so that was the point where the scales tipped and I realised that there was no way back. They weren't going to be fair, they weren't going to be honest about it. They were out to get me.
Over the next 18 months, Wallace was offered four separate jobs, only to have each offer withdrawn when the employer sought references from the Ministry of Defence. Finally, in late 1976, he got a job with the local authority in the south of England, and for the next few years, life had apparently returned to normal. By 1980, Wallace was so settled in his new life that he agreed to speak off the record to an Irish Times journalist. The newspaper published allegations that there had been an MI5 plot in 1974 to undermine Prime Minister Harold Wilson. For those in the know, it wasn't hard to identify the source. They could have been forgiven too for suspecting that Wallace was also behind another newspaper's expose that same year of the Kinkora sex abuse scandal, which led to the home's closure. Events quickly took a sinister turn. A friend of Wallace's turned up dead in the local river, and the Home Office pathologist ruled out foul play. But after Colin Wallace was arrested in connection with the death, the same pathologist changed his mind. Now, he thought, it had been murder. Skeptics may ridicule him for it, but Colin Wallace says he was being deliberately framed.
The police officers arrived in a civilian car. They literally came to the door, said, "Can we come in?" Eileen and I were both in the living room, the lounge. They just walked into the room. The senior officer said, "You're being charged with the murder of Jonathan Lewis." Went through the formal procedure. Wasn't handcuffed. Taken out, put in the back seat of the car, taken to Littlehampton Police Station, and basically locked up. Appeared in court first thing the next morning, and then taken from the court to Lewis Prison.
The trial of Colin Wallace was highly publicised. Wallace had been romantically linked with the victim's wife before her husband's death, and the prosecution argued that he had murdered for love. The trouble was that there was no hard evidence that Jonathan Lewis had been killed, never mind that he had been killed by Colin Wallace. The circumstantial evidence seemed contradictory, and Wallace asserted his innocence throughout. In the end, the murder charge was thrown out by the judge, who asked the jury instead to consider a charge of manslaughter.
Somebody once said to me, "Beware when the jury won't look at you when they come in." And I could remember that very clearly because the jury filed in and not one of them looked my direction, whereas normally they look over to see how you're taking things. And they came up with the unanimous verdict, guilty. So the judge then sent me to 10 years and I was immediately taken downstairs and handcuffed to wait for the prison van to escort me out. My lawyer was allowed to come down and see me, my barrister, and they brought Eileen with them, but I only had a few minutes. Was then taken out, put in a prison van, and I arrived in Wormwood Scrubs Prison at about 9 o'clock, I think, at night. It was late on anyhow. And that's one of the things that really stuck in my mind. It was blowing windy and driving rain, and I can remember being escorted from the prison van into the reception area. And I was escorted with a prison officer with dogs. You know, you suddenly go from one end of the scale, I was part of the security forces, and within a short space of time, I'm being escorted as a high-risk prisoner. But you have to go through the whole indignity of the system. You have to get stripped, showered. Got to my cell, and lots of the plaster had fallen off the wall, and it was lying on the floor. And there was this incredibly bad stained mattress. If you had to make a horror film about prisons, this would have been it. It was really bad. So made my bed up and literally just curled up in bed and went to sleep. And I can remember waking up in the morning with the door opening. And this prison officer looked in and he said, "Read all about yourself." And he threw me a copy of the Daily Telegraph.
For Colin Wallace, life had come undone. Now nobody would believe what he had to say about out-of-control intelligence agencies and the cover-up of abuse at Kinkora. Certainly his imprisonment was convenient for the targets of his criticism. Wallace felt it was more than a coincidence.
It was quite clear at that stage that the trigger seemed to be Kinkora, and at that stage I thought that the intelligence services believed I knew more than I did about Kinkora, and therefore that if I did give evidence to an inquiry, I could be really very damaging to them. And I think to this day that what happened to me was an attempt, or several attempts, to discredit what I might say about Kinkora. And an Army intelligence officer at Lisburn, after I left, complained about Kinkora exactly the same as I was summoned to MOD and was told that he would be disciplined if he continued with it. But I think the intelligence service was using it as a means to put pressure on, to blackmail, to get people to do what they wanted to do.
During Wallace's 6 years in prison, it emerged that many boys from Kinkora had made complaints to various authorities, but no action had ever been taken. Investigators sought interviews with Wallace, but the Ministry of Defence denied permission for him to speak freely. Meanwhile, a banned book called Spycatcher was making headlines, claiming sensationally that MI5 in the 1970s had been plotting against the Labour government.
Suddenly, out of the blue, came the story of Peter Wright. And Peter Wright, of course, I knew because he'd been in Northern Ireland in my time. And it was amazing because something I had said and put on record years ago, had still got my notes of that, here was a senior MI5 officer, believe it or not, saying the same thing. I mean, this was absolute manna from heaven. I couldn't believe that this was happening. So, of course, I started writing again furiously to the Prime Minister and everybody else. But, you know, you could imagine that with the sensitivity of that, the last thing they wanted was, a convict who was raising trouble as well. And in the middle of the, when I was really on my last stage of coming out without parole, I was sitting in my cell one day at lunchtime when the door opened and the prison officer came in and said, the governor wants to see you. And he said, you're going home. And that was it. And all the prisoners were actually really kind. They were all coming out before, and lots of them had made cards and stuff and shoved it onto the door. And I packed up all my belongings. I'd inquired over the years, my books and bits and pieces, put it all in a cardboard box. And there were just dozens of press everywhere when we came out, because they all wanted to know about Peter Wright, Spycatcher and all the rest of it.
He was out of prison, but the campaign continued. As far as Wallace was concerned, he still had an unfair dismissal and a false conviction for manslaughter to overturn. In 1987, a young Labour MP, Ken Livingstone, used his maiden speech in the Commons to highlight Wallace's claims. But Thatcher continued to deny the existence of Clockwork Orange and that Wallace had been anything more than a press officer.
The phone rang and it was my Member of Parliament. And he said, there's going to be a statement in the House about you tomorrow. And he said, I have no idea, they're not telling me what it's going to be. And the next day, Secretary of State for Defence Tom King announced that the government had, quote, inadvertently misled Parliament over my case, and they had now found files that indicated that I had a job in certain areas and it was classified. And as a result of what they found, they had commissioned Sir David Calcutt to carry out an investigation. So it was suddenly on the news, because as soon as it was announced in the House, there was a sort of a major eruption, because MPs are suddenly saying, we've been misled. And all the people who put down questions, who were told there was not a shred of evidence to support anything I said, were clamouring now for blood.
I have come to this House to report on a matter on which we are clear that a mistake has been made, and we are anxious to remedy that at the earliest possible opportunity. And people jumping up and down, one after the other, and I could join the club.
It was a most extraordinary U-turn. The government was now conceding that Colin Wallace had a secret job title in the 1970s, that there had been a psychological operations unit at Lisburn, and that Colin Wallace had been involved with a disinformation project called Clockwork Orange. They continued to deny, however, that there had been any cover-up of Kinkora or a plot to undermine the Labour government. The inquiry found that Colin Wallace had been wrongly dismissed from his job and that those dismissing him had known the dismissal to be wrongful at the time. He was awarded compensation, but the manslaughter conviction remained.
Suddenly, Whitehall was beginning to question a lot of things that were happening. And then the Home Secretary announced that he was going to send the case back to the Court of Appeal for review. And it was at that point that the lawyers really got busy, brought in the forensic experts. But the appeal was terrific, because I think then sitting there and having been on the receiving end of it when I was convicted and feeling frustrated and angry and almost finding it hard to believe what was being said, then do you see the lawyers taking that case apart in the most sort of remarkable way and seeing the Crown case dissolve and seeing the Crown walking away from its own evidence was absolutely wonderful.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical, your online antidote to corporate media crap.